Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show and prove. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
Let me say this, that, see, we have to, as black people, we have to be aware that black people whose ancestors were enslaved and brought from the African continent to the Americas, that we were not brought and enslaved for the purpose of maximal development. And if anything, we were enslaved for the purpose of working on plantations and producing other slaves and breeding and studying, and just, that's S-T-U-D-D-I-N-G, producing offspring for the slave master to have more slaves or to sell to other plantations. That's what we were brought to do. And to the extent that we have not thought through sexual activity, what I would call revolutionary sexual activity, then because slavery was a phase of the system of racism, white supremacy, then we are just going forward breeding and studying and producing children that we cannot take care of in producing children because we're playing with sex and we don't have an understanding of racism, white supremacy. And so then the children are just taken through the inferiorization process that the system of racism, white supremacy has in mind. And so we have to do some very deep thinking. This is, sex is magnificent. Sex is the act that allows human beings to do what the creator of the universe can do, and that is to produce another human being. And so this is magnificent activity, but under the system of racism, white supremacy, it can become a degraded activity. And so when it does, it has to become activity that people begin to think very deeply about and take very seriously the idea of bringing a new life onto the planet when we are victims of a system of racism, white supremacy. So our goal should be bringing forth a black child who is going to be able to participate in countering a system of injustice, and so that the system of injustice of racism, white supremacy is eventually replaced with a system of justice. So that's a whole lot to think about before people engage in the act of sexual activity. If we're not mindful, then we will bring a child into the world and we ourselves will mistreat the child and devalue the child. And then the child will begin to wage war against black people. The child will not, if the child is not taken care of appropriately, the child will not learn to love and value him or herself, or learn to love and value other black people. and we will have people who indeed will hate themselves and hate black people and will therefore indirectly be a supporter of the system of racism, white supremacy.
The Grandcestor, Dr. Francis Cress Welsing, author of the ISIS Papers, The Keys to the Colors. This is the context of white supremacy. Always grand to hear Dr. Welsing's voice. It is Wednesday, October 2nd, 2019. So I have been told for folks who maybe this is your first time hearing the cows or you are a new listener, newer listener. We have been on for a decade plus. Dr. Frances Cress Welsing, before she passed in 2016, 31 times a guest on this program to cover a wide range of subject matter, all related to the system of white supremacy. You can go back in the archives and hear a plethora of her, including her prediction in 2015 that the current occupant of the White House, again, I'll say in 2015, she died almost a year before the election and still well documented her prediction that the current occupant of the White House would indeed be our next president. I think that is one of her best moments of brilliance to be so far. And she was saying this when people weren't even taking his run seriously, when it was just a joke, reality TV. She was saying then, your next president, because of her understanding of white supremacy, racism, what it means to be classified as white. I started specifically with that clip. It is rare. Our guest for today's program is an author. We've had lots of authors on the program over our decade plus of broadcast. I just mentioned two. We've had a lot of authors from all over the world as guests on our program. It is still relatively rare, kind of a surprise, when I read an author and they quote Dr. Francis Cress Welsing and Neely Fuller Jr. Wow. I give a big eyebrow raise. Most of the non-white people that we've had on the program, either they're not too familiar with them, they certainly are not well-versed enough to be quoting from their book. So I say, wow, and then no less. Our author is visiting, or joining us, not even in the States, from Canada, no less, and he's still well-versed with Mr. Fuller, Dr. Francis Cress Welsing. Joining us today, our guest, in addition to being an author, spent decades as an enforcement official north of the border in Canada, years as a member of the Royal Canadian Mounted Police. Really amazing credentials and accomplishments as an enforcement official. But we do have a program every Friday called Neutralizing Workplace Racism. Let me give you the full title of the book, and you'll immediately see why this came to my attention. So the full title of the book, Black Cop, My 36 Years in Police Work and My Career-Ending Experience, or experiences, plural, not just one, experiences with official racism. Even in the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, white supremacy racism? Yes. Specifically, the audio segment you heard about Dr. Welsing, where she talked about throwaway children, something she's talked about all the time, and the importance of having children and in a system of racism and valuing children. And even she wrote in the ISIS papers, we don't have families, we have survival units. Our guest quoted that very portion in the book. I said, wow. Wow. Always look forward to those type of programs. In addition, this is like a twofer. I always enjoy talking about workplace racism and trying to come up with strategies, things that non-white people can do to neutralize problems in the workplace. This week, it's like we're having two programs on workplace racism because this book is pretty much all about workplace racism, white supremacy. Some of the things that you hear are painfully familiar. Black person working and doing exemplary work for a decade. Can I get a promotion? A promotion? Is that? But no. Painfully familiar, even north of the border. Our pleasure to have on the program joining us live. So much to talk about. Joining us live from Halifax, Nova Scotia, in Canada, Mr. Calvin Lawrence. Mr. Lawrence, are you with us, sir?
Yes, I am. I'm in Ottawa, Ontario. I'm from Halifax, Nova Scotia, so you were close.
Thank you for the correction. So glad to have you on the program and happy to talk about your book, Black Cop. We will dig into as much detail as possible and give our listeners a chance to dial in. Maybe some of our Canadian listeners, they'll have a chance to dial in as well. Before we get started, for folks who have not read your book and or seen some of the other interviews and pictures of you, you are a black male. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Right on. If it's acceptable, is it all right for me to ask your age?
Yeah, I'm 70, 7-0.
Right on. This program, Dr. Welsing, Mr. Fuller, guests many times, they use the terms white supremacy, racism as synonyms. We do the same. Dr. Welsing gave a very comprehensive, detailed definition of racism, white supremacy, and she encouraged everyone, make sure you ask and supply a definition of racism. If you don't have a definition of racism that makes sense, you're not going towards solving the problem. Our definition for white supremacy racism is a global system of people who classify themselves as white and are dedicated to abusing and or subjugating everyone in the known universe whom they classify as not white. Do you think such a system exists? Do you think that definition is accurate?
One of the things that I follow Neely Fuller, and I also follow Dr. Francis Welsing, Dr. Claude Anderson, Malcolm X, Louis Farrakhan, minus the religion, and Dr. Amos Wilson, the late Dr. Amos Wilson. And one of the things that Mr. Neely Fuller says in his book is that it is a guide. And when you say the definitions, my definition is one race maintaining dominance and control over another race in the nine major areas of people activity that Mr. Fuller lays out: economics, education, entertainment, labor law, politics, and religion, sex, and war. And that is my definition. I try not to use racism or white supremacy as a word. What I try to do is use white supremacist behavior or racist behavior, because one, when you talk about racism, we talk about it like it's on a shelf, and we catch it like a cold, racism. But I like to attribute it to the behavior, inaction, or speech of a person classified as white, now or practicing white supremacist behavior. Now, sometimes I'll say white supremacist behavior, not to be confused with white behavior. Now, the big question is, well, what's the difference? The difference is deception. So there's your two-week course on racist behavior. Deception. Remove the deception, you will remove the racist behavior. That's basically how I categorize my way of thinking. And I'm in the area of law, the people activity of law. I'm not in the prison system. I touch on the court system, but I'm in the law enforcement area. And I am a seventh-generation black Canadian. And there are a number of multi-generational Canadians, black Canadians here.
All right. I appreciate, thank you for sharing your definition of racism. I always appreciate if we have people who have a different opinion or view, they can share what their definition is and listeners can evaluate. That is grand. Dr. Welsing has a different definition, Mr. Fuller as well, Dr. Amos Wilson, some of the other folks you mentioned. On this program, I do try to make sure I do get answers to the questions, and the question about the definition of racism, white supremacy I supplied, that is an important one. And if you don't think it's accurate, that's completely fine. But I would appreciate if we could get an answer to that one. So the definition: a global system of people who classify themselves as white and are dedicated to abusing and or subjugating everyone in the known universe whom they classify as not white. Do you think such a system exists? Is that definition accurate?
The definition is accurate. I think in my way, I'm saying the same thing in a different way. So I would say she is accurate. And I would say we're both saying the same thing in a different way. So yes, the question is yes.
Much obliged.
The answer is yes, sorry.
No apologies. Much obliged, Mr. Lawrence. Wow, there's so much. I'm going to try and read some snippets from Black Cop and obviously ask you some questions about your, extraordinary career in law enforcement and even a pugilist, someone who should have been at the 76 Olympics fighting for a gold in the heavyweight division. If you would like to give kind of a quick summary, you gave some of it as a seventh generation Black Canadian. Any other details that you'd like to share quickly before we get into the book?
Okay, York Lawrence was the property of Catherine Lawrence in the province at the time of Albany, New York. And he came to Port Roseway, Nova Scotia, as an indentured servant or perhaps an escaped slave. And Port Roseway was the, if you've ever heard of the Book of Negroes, there was a movie and there's a book. And I'm one of those people that came from that segment of the United Empire Loyalists who were Black, and if they fought for Britain, Great Britain, England, they were given parcels of land. It is now called Shelburne, Nova Scotia, and the area where the Black people lived was called Birchtown, Nova Scotia, and there were segregated areas in each town of Nova Scotia or each city of Nova Scotia where Black people would live, work, and then come into the community. So there's a long history of Black people in Nova Scotia, multi-generational Black people. And the culture that we grew up with was American culture. So if you see somebody like me, indigenous to Canada and Black, we grew up on American culture.
Wow. Heard that from a number of Black people, not just in Canada, but around the world, really. The impact of American culture, even what some people call Black American culture. In fact, you write about that in the book, especially Black music and the impact that had. And you all spent so much time listening to that. I suspect that's probably, well, I don't know, Drake had a big impact. But anyway, we've heard that from a lot of folks who've come on the program. I guess to jump into the book, Black Cop, before I start to get into some of the details that you share, how long did it take you to write this book?
Well, I wanted to write it for a long time, and I wanted to write it actually when I was still a serving member. I retired in 2006, but I started a little bit. I thought about it. And at that time, there wasn't as much to put in the book as there is now. So maybe there's divine intervention there or something. I don't know. But at any rate, it took me about a year working with, and I got to give a shout out to Miles Howe, who was able to pick apart my life and pick out the important aspects of what I wanted to put in the book and put it in his own words. That's why the book looks so good. So I'd like to give a shout out to Miles. Miles Howe.
Much obliged to Miles Howe. I'm sure he did a lot of great work in piecing the story together, but I will disagree there and say that the reason the books look so good is because of your life and work. I mean, wow, there would have to be a story for him to put together. Let's get to the story. So Paige, okay. This is page 8 of Black Cop, and you will see why I picked the, or maybe, hopefully, you'll understand why I picked the audio clip. You're right. I could tell you that there was family dysfunction. I could say that intergenerational trauma didn't allow my parents to make healthy decisions for the family. The history of racial abuse made everyone, including myself, hypervigilant. I'm satisfied with knowing what I know. Although I did call my aunt and uncle, mom and dad, I know I was loved and nurtured by two sets of parents. Through later conversations with family, I came to realize that the circumstances of my childhood weren't unusual. All around me, kids were being raised by their grandparents, aunts, uncles, and cousins. We simply could not afford, nor were we necessarily comfortable with, the nuclear family model, and in those days, bringing a child up was more of a community affair. In my case, this meant that the seventh child in the house, the latecomer, was too much. So that kid, me, was given to my father's brother and his wife, who had none of their own, and we still all stayed close and visited whenever we could. Although this arrangement of intrafamilial adoption might seem strange to you, it's not at all unusual to have extended family raise a child in the Black community. To paraphrase Dr. Frances Welsing from her book, The Isis Papers, The Keys to the Colors, in a society dominated by white supremacist behavior, it's impossible to have a functional Black family. For Dr. Welsing, a family operating under these circumstances is less of a family and more of a survival unit. Any family in which the members are regularly harassed, bullied, underemployed, or unemployed is going to be off balance. If you're Black, it doesn't matter what you did or what you do. If you're a Black person, you are, from cradle to grave, the target of racist behavior. I'll stop there, and you have a photograph of you with your father, Colin, 1953. Really intimate information. I mean, this is page 8 of the book, so this is really intimate information about you and your family, along with Dr. Welsing grounding this in her theory of white supremacy racism. Why did you want to start Black Cop in this manner with such intimate detail, and then including Dr. Welsing to kind of give some analysis of your family situation?
Well, what I wanted to do is start off with, because my adopted mother was white and my father was Black, I came up with a pretty well a clean slate when it comes to racial conflict. There was nobody in the home saying, well, I hate Black people or I hate white people. But what I came away with was my father worked on, and Black people can understand this, my father worked on the railroad. And that was a prestigious job for Black people at that time. So I knew that he went through racist behavior because you're a child and you hear things. And I know that he was angry at times about some of these things. And I wanted to start off, for me, with no preconceived ideas of racial conflict, which I didn't have. Now, some people call that naive, but that's okay. I think it made me a better police officer. But as I went into the system, I experienced and I could tell that rather than isolated incidents, it was a system that used Black people to a degree. And that's basically why I wanted to start off that way, how I thought from the time that I was born and a young child to how I ended up with the book Black Cop.
Wow. Your adoption situation, having a white mom, and you talk about in the book not knowing how her family felt about her being married to a Black male. Did you get the sense that they were not pleased about this arrangement?
Well, it wasn't written on the fridge or anything, but I felt, and basically society around me felt that there was something wrong with this. Judging by my own interactions with Black and white women, I could see that there was always a conflict of people going with different races, and you see it today. There's, people have a white wife or a Black husband or whatever. So that goes on today. It even goes on in our own communities with skin tone. you know, if you're really light or if you're darker or whatever. So that always plays a part in society, and I think that it was necessary for me to point that out because that's the world we live in.
You said when your mother passed, you didn't even know anyone from her birth family to notify of her passing. Is that
no? That's unfortunate. I think there was a combination of family of origin issues, and whatever went on from a racial component that ended up with that sad situation.
Mm. You talk you talk a lot in the early part of the book about a lot of the abuse that you encountered growing up, much of it racial, insults, taunts, that sort of thing, being bullied physically, bullied frequently, and being really reluctant to fight back, and that being difficult for you. Were your parents, either your white mother or your black father, how did they help you understand these incidents, especially the racial component to the bullying that was happening to you as a child?
Well, it's funny. I laugh because my father's would not have taken that as a child. I mean, my father's didn't take anything like that, and my father would often scold me for not fighting back. It wasn't so much of fighting back because of race. It's just if somebody touches you, then you should fight back, and that's old school stuff. That's what we were raised on. You know, that, you know, if somebody touches you, and of course, if you're the bully, then they would come to my father and say, look, this guy did this, this, and this, and then you're in trouble, right? So that's old school. I mean, that's the way it was, that nobody went to, nobody had to take classes on bullying or anything like that, minus the internet today. But I mean, if somebody touched you, you were expected to defend yourself, and that was the way it was.
Did your white mother, did she kind of help you grasp, like, hey, this is, you know, I've gotten flack for being in this arrangement. This is the system of racism, white supremacy. Like, what did she have to say about all this?
Well, there really wasn't a discussion in the house about she is white and he is black. It was more of, you know, you're playing around, you're eating, you're doing something, and somebody would make, and my father would say, well, this person doesn't like us because we were in a mixed marriage. And it was that kind of picking up of what was going on through listening to conversations, because a lot of times, and people can relate to this, parents are talking and you're listening, and then years later you understand what they said to each other, but they weren't necessarily saying it to you.
I see. I was going to go to the mark on the dozens, or I guess I'll make sure. So what did you hear from your white mother in terms of how she explained racism to you, or suggestions that she gave you on how to deal with some of these problems?
Well, I guess she didn't go into it because, you know, they neither one were versed on the doctrine of racism and racist behavior and white supremacy. They just looked at it as somebody that was picking on their son or was making comments to their son. So again, as I said before, there wasn't a lot of talk in the house about black and white and racism. Only the talk was of their experiences and them mentoring me. And the way they did that is they simply said that, you know, again, if people call you names or whatever, that you don't go out there and start fighting. But if somebody touches you, then you're expected to fight back. And it was very plain, very simple. And my father spent a lot of time, I would say, teaching me to be a human being as opposed to being a black human being. But I knew it was there, and he knew it was there. But through his experiences on the railroad, he could explain to me, he's giving me examples without telling me what to do or what not to do. But he used to say, you know, learn to take a little bit. which means don't go off, don't fly off the handle when somebody says something to you. So they were words of wisdom.
Mm. You also include a lot about your father and his time working on the railroads. Very familiar. There were a lot of black people who worked. Minister Malcolm X, already mentioned on the program today, worked on the railroad and talked about his experience in his autobiography, which we read in our book club. I wanted to read this one passage here and just, yeah, this one passage here. We did have a cowbell today. You write, intimate detail. My mother would ask whether the kids bullying me were white or black. I answered that I didn't know. As a kid, I didn't see it. I couldn't make that racial distinction in my mind. Maybe it was because my mom was white and my dad black. Maybe I was just a slow learner or naive. I don't know. In our house, there was no talk of hating all white people or of all white people being racist. We weren't that polarized and we didn't generalize along those terms, and it never dawned on me that there was this tumultuous, generations-old race-based conflict going on around us, or that things were about ready to explode. Really important two paragraphs there, I thought. And we've talked about this regularly, even with Dr. Welsing and Mr. Fuller, the impact non-white people who have a white parent and how that can impact their understanding of racism, white supremacy, especially their understanding of what it means to be classified as white. And, you know, just that paragraph right there. Anything you'd like to add to those two paragraphs?
Well, basically, we didn't have the internet then, and we didn't have a lot we didn't have a lot of insight in Nova Scotia, and I think that the conflicts that took place in the U.S. Were not at the time taking place in Canada, and that all changed, of course, once the Black Panther Party came to Halifax and in Nova Scotia. So it was an extreme wave of change that came once the Black Panthers arrived. It was a shock to everyone, white, black, whatever, because it was sort of this is the way things are in Canada. It's not the refinement stage of racist behavior is extreme to the U.S. And I traveled throughout the U.S. and people usually don't do things or say things unless it's in a direct manner. Whereas in Canada, it's very close. It's like smoke in front of your face. You reach out, it's there, or hair in front of your face. You reach out and you're trying to grab, but it's just, you know, it's there, but you just can't get a handle on it. And that's Canada. And there's a lot of racist behavior that's taken place in Canada, white supremacist behavior with First Nations and black people that was never taught to us in school. We never learned it. We didn't know about it. And all my education is from reading books and some of the covers I've sent you in the email there.
I see. You talk in the book about the impact of the Black Panthers coming across the border to discuss options for responding to white supremacy racism. That is a pattern, too, that we've seen a lot in terms of not just U.S. culture and its impact, or black people born in the States and their culture and its impact. Frequently, it'll be cited how black people in the States are responding to racism, white supremacy, has an impact on other non-white people around the world. We've heard that many, many times. That's presented again in Black Cop. Before I ask you to share how that visit directly impacted you spending 36 years as an enforcement official in Canada, I want to make one correction. Mr. Lawrence and I spoke some weeks back in preparation for the program, and I was telling him that the Black Panther Party, Huey P. Newton, his father was an enforcement officer, but he wasn't allowed to arrest black people. And that is an error, but I was close. So I went back and checked to make sure, strive for accuracy. Deception is such a big part of white supremacy racism. Mr. Lawrence already said that. So the correction, This is a direct interview from Huey P. Newton. Huey P. Newton, a transcription. He said he was asked why the police was such a major target for them, and he talked about all the different problems that enforcement officials called the black people. So I'm skipping down a little bit, and he says, in Oakland, there was about, in 1966, there was about October 66 when the party was founded, there was about 1% black people on the police department. Shortly before that, and I think in 1953, Oakland had its first black policeman who was a friend of my father's. That's where I got the connection. His name was Kenner. My father broke the friendship with Kenner because of his membership in the Oakland police. Not because he was a policeman, but because at the time the policy was that Kenner could only arrest black people and he could detain a white person, but he would have to call a white officer. My father thought that that was degrading and it was no change from what was happening in the South. And I've heard that repeatedly. That was what I said. I think the only error I made was I said that his father was an enforcement official. That was wrong. It was his dad's friend, but that was what I thought. Now, so how did this Panther visit, if you can give us some information about that to give a little context for how that ended up having a direct impact on you spending 36 years as an enforcement official?
Well, here's how this kind of shakes out. Prior to the Panthers coming, there was talk of black people applying for to be a police officer. And they were pretty well shown the door. You know, it didn't happen. But once the Panthers came, for some reason, they hired the first black police officer in 1976. That was the first one. 19, they hired the first police officer, and then they hired about five more, of which I was one. And 1967 was the first black police officer, 1967. And I was hired in 1969. Now, there's two ways you can look at this. You can say, well, Halifax City Police went through a conversion, a way of thinking, and they decided they would hire black police officers. The other way you can think of it is that we're going to hire some black police officers, and this might settle things down, because we all know that if you send a black police officer to the black community, all the black people that commit crimes are going to give up and say, oh, this is a black police officer. You know, which is ludicrous, of course. So, in my way of thinking, they hired us as a knee-jerk reaction because the Panthers came.
Fascinating. I think there have been other comparisons of this is supposed to be some way of nullifying concerns of black people. We don't want the more radical black people to get involved. This will at least give the appearance that, oh yes, we are concerned. We've hired a few black people. You have a leading up to where you and Donnie Young, you all got this car ride. You get taken to the police department and talked about being there, kind of planting the seeds to doing this and joining law enforcement. But leading up to this, you write, this is on page bottom of 29. On an early summer day in 1968, I was hanging out at the Creighton and Garish Street, one of my favorite corners, with a good friend, Ricky Smith. As we often did, we were playing the dozens. The term refers to the days of slavery when substandard slaves would be sold by the dozen, which was considered the deepest of insults. Playing the dozens in the modern day meant throwing insults at each other and learning to take it without becoming physical or taking the game too seriously. It could be a joke about what you were wearing or a joke about one of your more noticeable bodily features. It could be a yo mama joke. It could be about losing your girlfriend to someone else. It could be any insult you could think of. This organized abuse dished out among ourselves allowed and still allows black people to build up a tolerance to the real abuse that we are inevitably forced to take from white society. And then you go back to riding to the police station and maybe being an enforcement officer. I read that and I was reminded, you'd already mentioned Dr. Welsing, so I had her on my mind. I was reminded Dr. Welsing has her list of 10 stops. And one of the things that she recommends that I'm a huge ambassador of, no name calling. She says things like the dozen, they do not toughen us up for the abuse of white people. It aids in that abuse because it sets that pattern of having disrespect and disregard for other black people, which she says is a key component to keeping all of this other, us being really nasty and not having any courtesy in how we treat, deal with other black people. What are your thoughts about that?
Well, I would take it into, if you have a family member and you banter back and forth, if you take it as bantering and that's it, then I think that, you know, it would be acceptable, but only individuals know how they can insult each other or not insult each other. If you look at, I was watching a program on Crave TV, that's a TV station here, called City on the Hill, and with Kevin Bacon, and there's a black DA, and this stuff is going on all the time, and you divide it up, in my way, I deal with it, I divide it up into bantering, and then you get into your sarcasm, and then you get into your real hardcore racist behavior. And some of it, of course, is refined. But I think that she's right. In a perfect world, she would be right. But when you get into policing, and you see, I have a list, basically, of the similarities between black culture and police culture, and both are not going away. Black people ain't going anywhere. Police aren't going anywhere. Both want to go home safe at the end of the day. Both get in trouble for snitching. Both have a culture. The bad guys in the black community hide within the black community. The bad guys in policing hide within the police community. Black people don't want to be judged as a group when one black person does something wrong. Neither does police officers when one police officer does something wrong. Now, the onus is on the police because they took the oath. So there's no written book that says, one, racial conflict is going to get better. There's no, who said that? There's no book. So it could get worse. It could get better. And, of course, the other thing is that if you're a police officer in that environment, there's no written book of how to deal with racist behavior, because in my book, which is pointed out very clearly, all the institutions that are set up to protect us and the people that are there to protect us doesn't mean a thing.
You point that out in painful detail throughout the book. You have a few passages where you talk about your relationship with your dad. It reminded me of that piece about the name calling and how that it might serve some sort of purpose in a system of racism. And I guess I'm contrasting that in a system of racism that is so toxic and abusive to black people, and there's so few opportunities for genuine healing, warmth, that just the system doesn't allow for that. I contrast that to, this is one of the scenes you have with portions where you're talking about your relationship with your dad early on before it goes into a lot of the experiences as an enforcement official. You write, "My father couldn't express his emotions, which I think is a relatively common condition among black men. Racist society dismissed his pain as irrelevant and unimportant, and therefore without social remedy or recourse," what you just said. "With expressions of pain unavailable to him, my dad turned towards one of the few emotional options open to him, anger. This anger, with its root causes unacknowledged, slowly turned to rage. This rage without an outlet was subsequently internalized and became depression. The depression, overwhelming at times, sought to be numbed. In his case, my father turned to alcohol. Boy, that's a big theme coming to that one. The fear, disillusionment, hopelessness, and helplessness that he must have often felt was not shared. He kept that to himself. When you can't process your emotions, how can you tell your own child how they'll feel the first time a white person calls them a nigger? Because it will happen. And so instead of learning these lessons, we boxed in the kitchen, punching each other because we didn't know how to hold each other and cry. During those intimate moments, we connected. That is from Black Cop, Black Lawrence. I'm sure Mr. Howe played a role, but wow, that is Mr. Calvin Lawrence. The brilliance shared right there. But I feel like if you contrast that with the dozens, I think it's the warped system of white supremacy where that can be expressed as black culture, and something that I've heard many people say with pride, like the dozens, name calling, being aggressive and degrading with another black person. But this experience that you just shared with your dad, not being able to talk about real pain, real issues that are being caused by racism, we're not able to do that, and might even be a fear that we might be ridiculed for doing so. What are your thoughts?
Well, I think that, see, I have a saying that I teach boxing, and I have a saying, and I used to teach at the academy, the Royal Canadian Mounted Police Academy, and the saying that I have is, only the herd can afford the luxury of appearing soft. You got to let that sink in a little bit. Only the herd can afford the luxury of appearing soft. So I am able to work in areas like public housing areas, and I'm also able to work in areas that are we say affluent. Now, you treat people the same, but you cannot please communities the same. But you treat people the same. And I don't feel that as a youth growing up, of course, teenager, youth, you have this bravado, you have this this way of looking hard, but that disappears if you do something like boxing, because you learn very quickly once you get the punch in the head, either you're not going to come back and keep trying to act hard, or you're going to come back humbled. And hence my saying. So this is what I tell police officers. You don't have to go out there with this hardness, because if you do, I know you're soft. You know, only the hard can afford the luxury of appearing soft. If that makes sense.
That makes sense. That is Mr. Calvin Lawrence, author of Black Cop, joining us live from Canada, context of white supremacy. You shared with us a visit from the Black Panther Party to Canada that motivated individuals classified as white within the police department in Canada to start hiring a few black people. They slowly started hiring a few. You were one of the first few, late 1960s. You write, this is on page 49, by virtue of being black, sometimes Ricky and I were added into police lineups for victims to identify their perpetrators. On several occasions, one of us was picked out of the lineup as the criminal. Whenever this happened, the whole office would have a good laugh at our expense. Being inquisitive, I used to look up the names of people I knew who had been charged and read the circumstances of their arrests and convictions. Nobody was really keeping tabs on me, so I'd find an unused corner of the station and flip through the folders and take a look at their mugshots. As a nosy youth, it was fascinating to read how kids in the community had gotten arrested and what they'd done. It also gave me a look into the inner workings of the detective office. I thought the first portion of it stood out to me, like, just that, I mean, you have a lot of tacky instances of racism, but at the time, you're a very young guy, early 20s, first started out. Did you view this as racism at the time, or did you think, oh, this is just, you know, silliness with the office, no big deal?
You mean about the lineup?
Yes, sir.
Yeah. I never viewed it as racism as much as, you know, the old saying, we all look alike, any nigger will do, that kind of thing. Now, I don't know if it was subconscious, I don't know if it was intentional, but we tend to get lumped in, and you see that all the time these days when people are stopped. Well, you know, we tend to get lumped in with the black person that they're looking for, if they're looking for a black person. But I think when we generalize, we lose accuracy. And the reason why I say white behavior, not to be confused with white supremacist behavior, is because there's a lot of white police officers that I've worked with and worked in the black community with, in the black community where I grew up. They were never born there and raised there, and they did a very good professional job. So I look at that, and I look at situations where they would count on me and I would count on them. And the bantering, we might even banter. I mean, I have a person that I've worked with, and we just hooked up. He's white. We worked together for 50 years. We didn't work together. We knew each other for 50 years, and we worked. He left and went in the RCMP with me after Halifax City Police. So you form bonds with people, and that can only be understood when your life is in danger, and that race doesn't play a part in anything. The perpetrator could be white, the perpetrator could be black, but you and your partner are working together for justice, for social justice, or for justice, I should say. So when you are thrown into that environment, your principles are tested. You know, you have a lot of people that say, well, you know, I would never, I don't want anything to do with my son or daughter if she marries somebody black or white. And then they do, and then there's a grandchild. Now you're put face to face with your principles. It's easy to have principles when they're not tested. But see how easy it is to have principles when they're tested, if you can stick to those principles. So you have to come up with a program, process, way of thinking, schema, if you call it schema, S-C-H-E-M-A, of your way of thinking. And I've stood up and I've defended my way of thinking, my way of policing, and I can still walk with my head held high and be greeted in my own community. I can still go to the police community for those police officers who are just white and not practicing white supremacist behavior. I can make my way through society, and I can write a book like Black Cop and say, this is the way it is. Don't shoot the messenger. I'm not reacting in anger. I'm not reacting in resentment. I'm just telling you the way it is.
Sometimes they do shoot the messenger, especially if it is a black person, unfortunately. We have talked, and this discussion has gone on for decades, about whether or not black people should even join police departments, because they are often just the enforcement division of violence for racism, white supremacy. You talk about this in the book. In fact, when we spoke on the phone some weeks back, you said you had endured all of that, being called an Uncle Tom. You talk about some of that in the book as well. We've had people, you know, who've called into the program who've expressed the same viewpoint, that because it will not be possible to practice justice, it is just going to be you helping to support the system of white supremacy, and probably by locking up other black people or policing them if you're in the incarceration component of it, enforcing, you know, their sentence once they have been convicted and that sort of thing, that black people shouldn't even seek employment in any of those fields. You write in the book, this is page 61, I know of black officers from the community who were hired later on who couldn't continue to live on Creighton Street because of the harassment they got from some of their black neighbors. I can only encourage the black community as a group to stop and think about it. If you want that representation, you have to support it. You can't complain about not seeing black police officers in the community if you chase away black cops who are actually from the community. I guess I'd ask for your response, particularly given you have so much inside knowledge and you present so many times and illustrations of where you as a black enforcement officer were being used and where they would offer you positions like, oh, no, we're having some racial strife. Could you come and be our community liaison and help us kind of tamp things down? You presented so many illustrations of that. What would you say to people? Say, yeah, I just don't think it's going to be a constructive investment of time. It's not going to help us solve racism. And you'll just be used as a tool for racism, white supremacy. What would your response be?
Well, then I go back to one of the cultures that we agree upon. The police. Nobody can dispute this. The police are not going away. There will always be police officers. The black community is not going away somewhere. There are always going to be black people. Now, the choice is, do you hold individuals accountable in the black community and in the police community? Or we just say, okay, we're going to fight. And now, keep in mind, all black people don't think alike. So there was a call by some black people, we want black police officers. Now let's break that down. Why do you want a black police officer? To be treated with respect and dignity? To let you do what you want and not arrest you? So I would say, okay, if somebody says that, which they did, black people, I'd say, okay, now, why do you want a black police officer? Then you say, well, we want a black police officer because he'll treat us right. And then you're going to say, well, no, hold on now, hold on. Maybe that black police officer will be more vicious and more violent against another black person just to have people in power that are white and practicing white supremacist behavior say, yeah, this guy's okay. He'll make it. He's ours. So then I say, well, yeah, I like to police my own community. I grew up there. I ran the streets there. I went to the clubs there, and I was a police officer there. I know when I am in the black community policing, in my mind, I'm doing it right. And my challenge to the black community was, if I'm policing you and doing my job, and you have a problem with that, well, we have no line of communication. But if you think that I am doing my job and I'm doing it wrong, then tell me. And this was a time when you could approach a police officer and talk to a police officer and argue with a police officer without getting arrested. There's so much that's changed. And working in my community, I was able to do that. And you often hear, well, if there's so many good cops, then how come they're never around when bad cops are doing things? Well, the answer is very simple, is that me being a black police officer standing next to someone who I knew didn't like black people was not going to step out of line, because I'm not going to report him. I'm going to stop him, and I'm going to say, you're not doing this. And I've only had to do that probably once, and you're not doing this. Because if you report the person, then you're in trouble. If you let him do what he wants to do, that's unethical and unlawful. So your choice is say, nope, right here, we stop, you're not doing it. And this is to anyone, black or white. And that was my way of doing things. And I think this is part of the reason I was treated the way I've been treated within the police organization. And that's all in my book. Because I was not going to be bought, and I was going to do policing the way it should be done. Because police officers are not going away.
Context of white supremacy. Alcohol. Let me give out the number, 605-313-5164, the code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you have a question for Mr. Lawrence. That number again, 605-313-5164, the code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. There is a moron who says pretty often sobriety would be best under conditions of white supremacy on a pretty regular basis. I'm sure you'll hear it again before the broadcast concludes today.
What was that quote again? I'm sorry.
Sobriety would be best under conditions of white supremacy. Probably hear it one way. I don't mind saying that one frequently. Lots of reasons. Been saying it for years. Will continue to, as long as the system of white supremacy exists. I will continue to be a teetotaler. I think that was the word he used in the book. That I've only heard Mr. Fuller use that one. That is a rarity where I even hear that word being used. I am in that camp myself. You write a lot about alcohol abuse in your time in law enforcement. Doesn't matter the division, it seems. It seems like a core component was alcohol abuse, not just, you know, we'll have one beer after hours and that's it, but rampant alcohol abuse. Can you share how much of a component alcohol abuse was for your time in law enforcement?
Well, in all police organizations and most military organizations, you have your own drinking messes and they're at subsidized prices. So, for example, I don't drink. Now, as I also say in my book, I was the enabler. I drove everybody around. I went to clubs. I ran the streets, you know, but I don't drink. So, of course, in some little areas, that's an asset because they can drive people around. But in bigger areas, they look on you as a spy. You know, you don't drink. Oh, something wrong with you. But that's society at whole. You know, if you don't drink, they either think that you're a reformed alcoholic or you're a spy or a teetotaler or whatever. I never consider myself that. But, you know, I would go to the mess. And this is where I guess you would call playing the dozens or whatever. And somebody, and I'd ask for a ginger ale or something, and they'd say, where's your pink suit? You know, because I'm asking for a soft drink. And I'd say, give me my ginger ale, or I'll throw this in you out in the street. And then he'd give me my ginger ale, and I'd take my stuff and go. You know, but I mean, I don't think it was more sarcasm than it was, insulting. But I mean, these are the things that, the way police officers talk to each other. And it never affected me, but it certainly affected people who were alcoholics. If you were standing there and your leg was cut open, there was blood, we'd all run over and try and help you. But a person who was an alcoholic, nobody wants to go in and tell that person he's an alcoholic, and nobody wants to tell that person he's an alcoholic if he's your supervisor. So there's always this alcohol component to policing. And I think that it is ingrained because of the steps that have been taken to ensure that alcohol is available and to ensure that in most cases it's subsidized pricing. And that's just the people that go to these places. They go out to bars, they go out to different areas. And there's a lot of police officers that get caught for impaired driving in Canada. I can't talk about the U.S., but there's you know, every once in a while, you'll see in the paper frequently a police officer caught for impaired driving.
Just to give listeners, I mean, a sample, because it comes up so frequently, and this is on 143. You write, as with any alcoholic family, every member is complicit. I found my space. I had to. It was either that or face complete ostracism and isolation. As usual, I played the role of the enabler. I was the stone sober cop driving a car full of drunken drugs squad officers, whites, I suspect, across southern Ontario in search of booze, debauchery, and fast nightlife. I'd driven them over the border to Buffalo, New York, so they could get wasted at the DEA Christmas party. I'm going to read that one again. I'd drive them over the border to Buffalo, New York, so they could get wasted at the DEA, for people who don't have all their alphabet organizations, that would be the Drug Enforcement Agency Christmas party. They get completely hammered, and then I load them all back in the car and drive them home at sunrise. I'm not proud of it, but that was the dysfunctional family that I belonged to. There would be times when we'd go out for lunch, it would start with a drink, and the next thing you knew, everybody would be getting drunk, and we'd call off the rest of the day. On more than one occasion, I had to figure out who was supposed to meet with whom that afternoon and call ahead and cancel all the meetings that were going to be missed due to drunkenness. Over cups of coffee and split lips, members, I suspect whites, often bragged about the fights they had started the night before. This, again, is enforcement agency, not McDonald's or some restaurant. Wow. And I read this in... Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead, Mr. Lawrence. Go ahead.
No, I partied with people, right? It wasn't like I was sitting there all upset and whatever. I mean, I'm a club goer. I mean, I ran the streets. I mean, you know, I was a player. I just didn't drink. And so it became a party starting out. And at the end, I was driving these guys home. And, you know, that's the reality of it. But it's not like you come and drive us and you're over there in one corner and we're all drinking over here. I was with them until they got to the point where I was no longer able to communicate with them effectively. And not everyone got plastered, but that was the general theme, right? Let's get out here and have a drink.
I mean, to me, what you write, it suggests this is institutionally promoted debauchery. The subsidized alcohol, and you talk about the recruits. I think this was with the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, where you talk about the cadets. They would, the instructors would sign a waiver that they're going to be responsible, almost seeming like it's suggesting, hey, yes, you are supposed to drink until you are blacked out and incapacitated, and we will, I guess, make sure you don't die in your vomit or something like that. We'll make sure you're relatively safe and can survive and go on with the training. I mean, just the magnitude of that, again, for law enforcement. And even to my thinking, like you, to dedicate so much of your life to working and being, hey, I'm proud to be an enforcement official and I want to do this job at the highest level possible. And these guys are going out and getting drunk at the lunch hour and things. You got to go and cancel meetings because they're so drunk. And then the taking home part, like I can totally understand if you're a party, I don't drink, but I'm here, I'll party, we can have a good time. But I mean, these are people, some of them got to be racist. Some of these people got to be the ones that are getting promoted when you're being denied a promotion and they're giving you all these excuses and practicing racism. And they're drunk sometimes.
Definitely.
On the job. And I'm, you know, getting them home safely and driving a bunch of drunk white people around. Like, it just, many portions of your book, many portions of your book struck me as being kind of sad. That is definitely one. Just being a black male and I'm driving around a car full of drunk white racists. And I'll stop there. Go ahead.
No, two things. Number one, not everyone that I drove around was a racist. Number two, if you're a police officer, I don't care where you are, Canada, U.S., you are going to see alcohol in the forefront. I'm just pointing it out, but that's the way it is in police culture. And the bottle is well in the forefront of police culture, the drinking. Now, as far as my driving them around, well, I worked with them. I socialized with them. You, or me, I should say, as a black person, you have to develop strategies and tactics to figure out who is actually practicing white supremacist behavior and who is not. And if you're in that environment, that's who you are. You're in that environment. That's where I work. And for people to say, well, you know, you shouldn't be a police officer. Well, in the global system of white supremacist behavior, we are victims of and participants in that system. You can't get out of it. So if you're a doctor, if you're working in a hospital, if you're a lawyer, if you're whatever you do, you're in that system, and you are going to encounter racist behavior. So you say, well, I'll leave. Well, where are you going to leave to? Because wherever you go, unless, of course, you just want to stay at home and watch Days of Our Lives or something, you're going to encounter racist behavior. And the more you try to move up into the system, the more you're going to find people who will try and hold you back. And some of the people that try to hold you back look like us, because they're on the forefront. They're the watchdogs. They bark. You know, there's a black man in the yard. So this is the system we live in. There's no sanitized way of going through life as a black person, because you will not go anywhere unless you deal with white people. And that is our fault. That is our fault. We have no black base. And wouldn't it be nice if Condoleezza Rice and General Powell and Obama fought for the betterment of black society, turned it inward? And we have not done that. We have assimilation fantasies, as is said, and assimilation fantasies lead to the illusion of inclusion. It's a fairy tale, and we all know with fairy tales, there's a happy ending. So again, I tell you what I did, but this is my living, and this is every black person's living in some way or another, whether they want to admit it or not.
I absolutely agree with that in terms of, hey, we are all victims of racism, white supremacy. If it's former President Obama, if you work as an enforcement official, as a school teacher, a janitor, postal worker, whatever it is, you are supporting a participant in the system of racism, white supremacy that is counter-racist logic. We've said that before many times. Mr. Fuller has said that on this program before many times. That is fact. But I did want to say, I did find it interesting. I started with, it struck me as sad, and it does, driving around drunk racists, or at least some of them, suspected racists, who are enforcement officials, driving them around after their debauchery and all that. That's, given your story and what follows, as kind of sad. From that to a critique of Condoleezza Rice and other black people who are victims of white supremacy and how they respond, that is amazing. I've seen that before, but be that as it may, you have many portions of workplace racism. We have workplace racism every Friday, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. We talk about some of these exact issues, including sobriety in the workplace, drinking in the workplace. We talked about that on a regular basis, happy hour, all of that. You write, wow, this comes up so much. At work, despite the rampant alcoholism and racist behavior, 1 and 2, I still tried in vain to earn the respect of my peers and supervisors. I still operated under the code that the merits of your work, no matter who you are, should determine whether you are promoted to higher levels of decision-making in an organization. Organizations with a deeply racist culture, however, destroy this mirage for you. They will never share the institutional power with a person of color. The culture simply will not allow it. In fact, they will fight you for it. The Royal Canadian Mounted Police policy at the time was that institutional promotions were supposed to be based on job performance, as demonstrated in your assessments and scores. The system was supposed to be blind to race, gender, sexuality, and religion. The problem was that the assessments and scores, the key to promotions and access within the organization, were in the hands of racist supervisors. If you don't look like one of them, then your accomplishments stood to be minimized and your opportunities restricted. through the white supremacist lens, when you're black and working hard, your hard work is interpreted as a threat. The harder you work, the more of a threat you become. And, in turn, the harder the system pushes back against you. That is a painful lesson, a painful conclusion, I would submit, to come to. That is something that I echo in the, on our Friday Workplace Racism segment on a regular basis. I think some other folks have come to this kind of painful conclusion. How long can you kind of describe the process of you coming to this realization in law enforcement, Mr. Lawrence?
Well, my as I've gone on and said, my slate was clean going into from a racial perspective. I didn't have any views one way or the other. I said, okay, this is a job. I'm going to do this job, and I'm going to treat people with respect and dignity. But there always comes a time when you have to make a choice. And that choice is looking in the mirror and being who you are, or going out and joining the fraternity and help and propping it up. And I looked in the mirror and I said, no, I can't do this. So I did my work. Excellent. One of the foremost authorities on protective policing in Canada. I protected ex-President Carter. I was in charge of the bodyguard team for ex-President Bill Clinton when he came to Halifax for the summit. So I became one of the foremost authorities in Canada in protective policing. And when I had my 10 years in and I was with the Prime Minister's Protection Detail, the supervisor there tried to scuttle a promotion that I was in line for. I was doing the job for 2 years now and tried to scuttle it. And this has happened throughout my career where I would improve my being, apply for something, and then instead of getting it, I would have to fight for it. And this is what brought me to that way of thinking. And I'm only talking about policing. I mean, we're not talking about me living a daily life or me trying to go to the Olympics. And my way was to simply outwork other individuals. And in doing so, I became a threat. People, you know, one guy said to me one time, oh, you're ambitious. Well, yeah. So what? Isn't everybody? But I didn't have to, I wasn't a suck. I wasn't a backstabber. I just went through the system the way it was written out. I worked hard. Now, I'm not naive. I know that was my protection. And that's why I can write a book the way I'm writing it, because I have all my assessments and that I was a good police officer. And the only thing you have to ask, not you, but the only thing the public have to ask, if you Google the core values of the Royal Canadian Mounted Police and compare it to my book, were they followed? And of course the answer is no. So you have to pick a, you pick a career, we pick a career as black people. And then we have to navigate through that career and to be successful. And there's no book on that. Nobody wrote a book on how to do this and how to do that. So all we can do now, what younger black people can do now, they can talk to me, they can talk to other people that are black police officers, and pick what they like and throw away what they don't. But when we're navigating our way through about all of this stuff, you're on your own. We are on our own. And people can criticize people, but what I'm looking at is people have a choice. And my choice was treating all people, including black people, with dignity and respect. And that meant if I was arresting them, or if I was if I had a physical confrontation with them, because again, police officers aren't going away. So if you want to take the police away, you can do that. But who is going to protect the sheep from the wolf, if not the sheepdog?
system of racism, white supremacy, non-white people are not safe. I'm so glad you mentioned the Olympics again. I wanted to make sure I included that. I'll nab folks who dialed in with questions for Mr. Lawrence in a second. The 76 Olympics, I had already read the portion, you and your dad doing some boxing in the kitchen, and you later found a gym and went and started to train and take boxing seriously, were athletic and got to be pretty skilled as a pugilist. You talk about your time working with the Halifax Police Department, and you start getting into amateur boxing and doing pretty well. So you have a few fights, you win a few fights. Hey, you're moving along. It's looking like, hey, this might be something, and it could be great. It would be great publicity for the police department. Hey, we've got this guy. He's on the force here, and he's a great boxer. Look at this. All around, it's great whoopee. No, no, no. That's not how this goes. And you're right, as your kind of amateur career is progressing. This is one instance. You write, you say Taylor went ahead and organized an amateur fight between Kevin Downey and me. And for whatever reason, this didn't sit at all well with the Halifax Police Department. When the department found out that I had a fight scheduled, I was called into the inspector's office and told I wasn't allowed to fight. This, Mr. Lawrence, you sound like a genius. I'm just saying that in this instance because you sound like exactly verbatim what I say on workplace racism and what Mr. Fuller recommends all the time. You ask questions. I'm going to keep reading. I asked whether I was violating any police policies or bringing disrepute to the force. Beautiful. Continuing, the inspector responded, no, no, we just don't want you to do it. I said, look at this. Well, am I allowed to do it or am I not? Well, technically, you're allowed to do it, but I said, well, the fight is already set up. Okay, then, just this once. Just this once. There are many instances, as I said, Mr. Lawrence should have been at the 76 Olympics. I'll let you, in fact, the question I'll ask, if you can explain why you should have been at the 76 Olympics fighting for a gold medal heavyweight division. Do you think if you were white, you would have at least been given the opportunity to earn your way to the 76 Olympics?
Well, I'll start off with the fact that I liked boxing. And as a kid, it is said in the book there, we go on Saturday afternoons and try to kill each other's brain cells. And I stuck it out. So I used boxing as a self-defense mechanism and also as a stress reliever. And that's for a number of years. I was just a sparring partner. I was a sparring partner to Trevor Burbick. I was a sparring partner to everybody in Nova Scotia. Now, when it came to the rules, it's not so much the fact that they told me that I couldn't. It was how they were telling me. See, this is where you what I was talking about, drawing a line. Now, I could have said, okay, no problem. Give it all up. Hope for a promotion. But if I wasn't doing anything wrong, then, and I was, and I did put the police department on the map, then I'm going to do it. Now, if I'm not doing anything wrong, I'm going to do it. Now, if you know policing and you know the way people think, they're going to punish you. They're going to punish you. So there was a person there who was involved in shooting, and he wasn't allowed to travel to do that. There was a person there who was a very good golfer, amateur golfer, and he wasn't allowed to do that. But they were allowed to do it in the city. They were allowed to do it in the city, where they're telling me that I can't do it. Plus, it's the way they're telling me I can't do it. So I look at it as two. They had the rule. Yes, they had the rule for a lot of people. I don't know how they talk to other people, but the way they were talking to me was threatening, as if I'm going to threaten you, and if you don't do what I say, well, you know, you may get taken off the payroll, or we're going to move the police station. If you go to the Olympics and you come back, you won't be here. So I just felt that they thought I was a bit uppity for even doing this because of the way they were talking to me. And so I would say, yes, they had a rule for everyone, but the rule always, and this is in my book, the rule is always different for me. I couldn't box in the city, but they could play golf in the city and they could shoot targets in the city, the other two, if that answers your question.
With the 76 Olympic spot specifically, the issue at that point became, hey, you don't have any extra time off, and we are not making any exceptions. You can't take time off for all this, you know, boxing nonsense. So I don't care what it is, Olympics, anything else. No way. That's the policy. And so that, I guess that's where I'll say, do you think if you were white, they would have had the exact same stance? Nope. This is the policy. We don't care. White person, black person, whoever it is, this is the policy. No time off for your side boxing projects, even if it's the Olympics. Or do you think they would have said, hey, maybe we can find a way. Maybe this would be good promotion.
Well, here's the comparison again. They had a softball team, and members who were working got time off to play softball. You know, and this is, you know, there's sandlot baseball, and then there's the Olympic Games. So now, if you want to compare, but again, sometimes you just have to say, you know, this is pretty refined here. This is pretty refined. Are they doing this because I'm a black man, or are they doing this because it's an unofficial policy? And that we go through that every day. Somebody will ask you to move, or somebody will say, well, would you mind doing this and that? And your mind is saying, well, are they asking me because I'm black? Are they asking me because it's a real necessity? And I would say if I was white, I think I would have been treated with a degree more respect than I was as a black person.
I think a lot more. And it's just the Olympics. I mean, wow. We could have somebody represent in the heavyweight division, no less, at the Olympics. Oh, man, that's such great. I think you would have been roundly. I think you even said that the officers, they proposed that the officers, they could donate some of their leave time for you. And you said, I don't want to be a charity case. I don't think it would have been charity at all. I think you would have been, you know, I don't want to say the mascot, but it would have been, wow, look at our officer here. Yeah, he's out.
But some members were a little bit, it wasn't all in agreement. Let me put it that way. I didn't put it in the book, but some of them weren't all in agreement about them. And you see, I won the Canadian Amateur Boxing Champion on my spare time.
Mm.
Everything I won on my spare time. And there could have been arrangements made where I would work and train.
Right.
But they didn't even delve into that.
Mm.
Because I was working three different shifts, changing every week, and I was still training.
Wow. Context of white supremacy, Mr. Calvin Lawrence. Last anecdote I'll get in from the book, and then I'll hit the phone lines. A lot of striking illustrations of workplace racism in your book. In my view, you not being at the 76 Olympics would be another. But one stood out. Many of them stood out, but one in particular stood out because I can only emphasize Dr. Wells, in which she's a local, national, global system of white supremacy racism. And I consistently encourage listeners, non-white people everywhere, look at the consistent behavior patterns that you see individuals classified as white exhibit. Now, Mr. Lawrence, again, he's in Canada. Can you tell us about the incident with the coon target? And he actually has an illustration of the coon target in the book. I cracked up laughing. Can you tell us about the coon target, Mr. Lawrence?
Well, one of the things that happens throughout, you know, in Halifax City Police, you'd see posters put up. And the poster in Halifax City Police was Nigger, Coon, Calvin Lawrence. And they were put on names on black people that were charged with their mugshots. And then I went to Toronto. There's a few places. I went to Toronto, and I think that's the other one there where it's in the book. It's official running nigger target. and that was put up outside a cubicle of one of the members. And, you know, first thing people, well, why didn't you complain? Why didn't you complain? Well, the bosses walk by the same cubicle. And nobody does that unless, nobody puts that stuff up unless they feel that they're going to get away with it. The other thing, too, is when you're in that kind of a system, you can't throw rocks at every dog that barks, or you'll never get anywhere. So you got to pick your battles. You got to pick how you fight them. And that goes on throughout the book, especially the end where I got information. I went fishing and I caught a bunch of emails and I caught a bunch of documents that supported my book. Without that, there would be no book. So weaving our way through the system, and people out there that are black and work in different places, weaving your way through the system is your own ability, your own cunning, your own process where to thrive and survive. Now, I thrive, but they violated all the rules to stop me. And the whole process, in my opinion, is that a dominant culture will never let another culture become dominant. They're not going to educate you into dominance. They are not going to give you anything that will give you dominance. And I think you're seeing that played out in the United States and in Canada today. It's white supremacist behavior. We are going to stay on top. We don't care what the rules are. We don't care what the laws are. We're going to do it. We're not giving up our power. And that is a culture clash. Now, in a culture clash, race becomes an identifier. In other words, somebody may say, well, I'm not racist, or I'm not a white supremacist, but I know my culture and I'm living well, and nobody is going to come in and become the dominant culture. I'm not even taking that chance. So that's another approach that you can take, you know?
Mr. Calvin Lawrence, author of Black Cop, the running, and there's so many. He said Mr. Lawrence, sounding like he listens to workplace racism almost, collected all of these little artifacts and things so that you have evidence. When you say racism, white supremacy is being practiced, what are you talking about? Whammo, evidence. But he collected some of these and has the illustration of the, this is, I guess, the official running nigger target. And I think this is important. I said it stood out for me because we've heard this before. They had the enforcement officers down in Florida. That became a big scandal just a few years ago. In fact, they didn't just have an outline of a black person. This is a black person with an afro. They would use actual pictures of black people who had recently been arrested, not convicted, arrested. They would take their mugshots and put the target on that and go shoot at it. Just the black people.
Yeah.
Just the black people.
Well, you had the good old boys picnic down in Polk County, Tennessee, where they had the nigger checkpoint. So they had a bunch of posters.
See, that's what I mean. Tennessee, Canada, Florida, global system of racism, white supremacy, and you see the same behavior patterns about encouraged, it's fun, committing violence against black people. Oh, that's a great way for pastime. Said again, our 10-year anniversary, white people kill for fun. But you wrote specifically, I've always refused to be intimidated, but I was shaken. I dismissed the notes and posters as cowardly bullshit. What concerned me more deeply, however, was whether these same people who were obviously my coworkers would be there for me when I needed them in an undercover operation. Would they protect me as a brother officer and keep my safety at the forefront of their minds, or did they really actually think I was a nigger who should just fuck off or worse? The conundrum weighed on my mind whenever I did an undercover job. These were real-time situations that required teamwork and trust that carry with them real risks and danger. Here I was, a hard-working cop who was trying to get drugs off the street so that your kids didn't get hooked. But given the types of blatant harassment I was experiencing out in the open in my workplace with fuck off nigger and Nigger Application Notes Left in My Work Basket, and an official running nigger target poster on the cubicle wall, I honestly worried about whether I'd be shot in the back by one of my coworkers, let alone by one of the armed drug dealers we were supposed to be trying to bust. Mr. Calvin Lawrence, black cop. Let's see. Caller at 1553. Did you have a question for Mr. Lawrence? You should be with us.
Hey, how you doing? Let me know if there's any noise in the background. I'm in the gym right now. Good evening to Gus and the guests. I'm Victim out of New Jersey. I'm going to try to get, I wanted to get three questions, but I'll keep it to three. But if I can get the last one, then just let me know, Gus. My first question. So you said, you made a statement to the guests. You made a statement and you said that people that look like you will be the ones most likely to hold you back. Do you have an example as your years on the police force when somebody black held you back?
I've had, well, this gentleman was East Indian descent, and I did more than my job description, and he criticized me for doing that in writing. Now, you have to keep in mind, too, that a lot of people are fighting for the steering wheel here. And a lot of people that are fighting for the steering wheel look like us. So maybe I just want to, you know, call the herd here and minimize the things that you have done or what you can do so I can get a hit. So that's the world. That's the way people, and not all people that do that are white.
Oh, okay. Because I mean, okay. Next question. And you said that the gentleman was East Indian descent, not black Canadian.
No, but there are black Canadians who I would suspect would do that in policing.
Okay. Okay. Thanks a lot. Next question. You said that if I'm not mistaken, because I don't want to put words in your mouth, you said there's a culture of just after work partying, drinking, and drugs. Would that be accurate?
I would say drinking, and I also know police officers who got involved taking drugs.
Okay.
But the general drinking aspect of policing is nothing new. I mean, that happens all over North America.
Right. Okay. So with that culture, and I do believe I could be mistaken that culture exists in the United States. However, do you think, being though that this culture does exist in the police force, that it should be mandatory of after any police shooting that police officer involved in said shooting should be tested for alcohol or any other illegal substance?
I think I never thought of that, but yeah, I would say that that should be part of it. But then you're going to deal with the police unions. So you have unions who protect police officers. They're not out to seek the truth, in my opinion. They're out to protect the police officer. They won't get elected again. So you'd have to go through them. You'd have to get a process. But yeah, just asking me that as a hypothetical question, I'd say yeah.
Okay. Hey, Gus, can I get one more question in, or is my time up?
Let's hear it.
Okay. Thanks a lot. Okay. You said that reasons for police, black communities' actions for a greater black police presence in their community. So, and through your police, do you think that black people want more blacks in the community for better treatment, or are black people just basically trying to have black people, more black officers, so they can get away with crime?
I'd say both. And I don't say it like, they don't say, well, I want a black police officer here so I can commit more crimes. But the minute you enforce the law, somebody says, well, you're not a brother. You're an Uncle Tom. And I've had that happen. And what I'm saying is it was a legitimate crime. Could be impaired driving, could be robbery, could be something. But because I policed my own community, I could also communicate with people and say, look, and I've said this, look, I know guys that have been in, you know, they disrupt bars and whatever. And I'd go in and I'd say, look, don't do nothing tonight until after midnight, will you? You know, I'm getting off at midnight. I don't want any trouble. I'm in uniform and I'm talking this way. And the guy says, okay. I mean, police officers don't know how to talk anymore. They don't want to talk or they don't know how to talk. But you can communicate to somebody and reason with these people, unless they're high on drugs or alcohol, but you can reason with people. And that does not seem to be happening anywhere in the U.S. or Canada.
Okay, man, Gus, thanks a lot. Always, as usual, great work, and peace and blessings to the guests. Thank you.
Much obliged, sir. Caller at 9029. Did you have a question for Mr. Oh, wait a minute. Mr. Lawrence, I just had one quick question. 9029, you will be up next. Mr. Lawrence, at any point in your 36-year law enforcement career, was there ever a time when there was a black person who was in a supervising position, a hiring position, where they had the decision-making power about whether or not you were going to get a promotion or a raise?
No, because the raise system doesn't work that way. Because we all get the same raise. But there have been situations where something was offered to me in relation to doing a duty and, another black person would say, well, no, we can do that. We don't need Calvin. We can do that.
Okay. Much obliged. 9029. Did you have a question for Mr. Lawrence?
Yes. Greetings, Gus. Greetings, Mr. Lawrence. Thank you for being on the program.
You're welcome.
Thank you. And a lot of things that you're speaking about, especially with workplace racism, very interesting to me, but also your situation growing up with a white mother in the household, how did that affect you as far as, because it, from what it sounds like from some of the things, it sounds like it didn't permit honest conversations about white people. And I ask that also because, as I've noticed with my family, as white people have come into my family, you know, people marrying white people, and they come to family functions, we talk less about racism, white supremacy. We don't want to put it out there because we don't want to make them feel bad or uncomfortable. Did you feel that was the action, what was actually going on in your household as well, you know, as a child?
No, I don't think that was the case in that time. What I felt was that people were more, you know, people were trying to survive. And, like, I've worked undercover jobs where you had transvestites, you had First Nations, you had blacks, you had people that, and you're in this bar, and the person that hits you is that they got no time to be racist or make judgments on anything. And I think that was a time that my mother and father were just trying to make it. And they gave me a middle-class upbringing. But I think that they started with very humble beginnings. And when I talk about this stuff, I say, look, there are people who practice white supremacist behavior. They wish to maintain dominance and control over non-white people in the nine major areas of people activity: economics, education, entertainment, labor law, politics, religion, sex, and war. And then there are white people. And white people are simply the beneficiaries of white supremacist behavior. But they're not actually practicing it. The beneficiary, they get it. They're part of that culture. But they're not out there trying to. And these are the people that I formed close bonds with over the years. They don't hate black people. They work, and I've seen them work in the black community. And they've never even been around people in the black community. They did a very good job. They were well respected and liked. And this is why I always say, look, you cannot generalize. Because how much do we hate it when a black person does something wrong and we're all targeted? Well, why wouldn't the same apply to police officers? That would be my question.
So, Mr. Lawrence, do you feel, to some degree, I kind of understand it. I think my perspective is, in a system of racism, white supremacy, these so-called black people are non-white are acting in a survival mode. You know, it's a situation where if they were put in the corner in between do your job or, you know, you lose your job, and that means hurting other so-called non-white people, they'll actually hurt other non-white people. And I think that's part of the system that we kind of overlook, is the fact that a lot of us are trying to survive, and that, you know, that...
Well, it's interesting. It's interesting that you bring that up, because here's the thing. When I was in Halifax City Police, and my parents, it was a small city, so, you know, people know your business, right? So if I'm out there and I'm taking people behind the building and I'm framing black people and beating up black people, forget internal affairs. I got a mom and dad I go to every Sunday for dinner. And if my father found that I was doing that, hey, man, I'm still my father's son. And the other side of it is that I drew lines in the sand. So there's no way if somebody says to me, you do something wrong to this person or lose your job, then I would say, I'm not going to lose my job, and I'm not going to do something wrong with this person, and I'm going to fight. And that's why I wrote the book, because I didn't capitulate to some of the things that they wanted me to do. So this is what happens. Okay. Yes, your career might be ruined. Well, go ahead and ruin my career, or try. That's my way of thinking. If you come after me, I'm coming after you. I'm not running from you. And whatever happens, just happens. That's just the way all boxers think, I guess.
No, I think that's actually some aspect of practicing black self-respect. But what I'm getting at is that I think
question.
It's difficult when you're... Yeah, that's what I'm asking is, did you ever feel that it was a situation where your mother prohibited or stopped some of the conversation, and, you know, obviously you went to the boxing because of that?
No, I don't feel that, that was part of it. I just think it was a survival mechanism for them, and they didn't have time to, like I said, with the bar explanation, they didn't have time to get into all of that, because they were trying to survive and raise me.
Okay.
Because they weren't, okay. They weren't middle class. They came up hard, you know.
Understood. One last thing: were there any instances where on your force where you did hear situations of predominantly mainly black males being abused on, you know, in situations as far as you were informed?
Well, black males or white males, they're not going to abuse them in front of me. And I only had one incident where I didn't even believe the guy. Anyway, long story short, I got him, brought him back into the police station. He said they're going to beat me up. And I didn't believe him. And sure enough, one police officer walked over and he was going to do something. And I said, no one's going to touch you. And nobody did. And I put him in the cells, and he was safe in the cells. So that's not going to happen. I don't care what color somebody is. You're not going to beat anybody up in front of me. And that has to do with my principles, but it also has to do with the fact that I'm not going to court and lie for you. And if you lie or tell the truth, your career is over in policing. That's the culture. Mm-hmm. So what you do is you just stop the guy right there and say, look, I'm not, this ain't going to happen. So you want to fight, you fight me. And then if you beat me up or I beat you up, there's no report.
Understood. All right. Thank you again, Mr. Lawrence. Very appreciative of you coming on the show. It sounds like a very tough journey you've been through, and appreciate your time and energy. Thank you, and thank you, Gus.
You're welcome, and you can get my book on Amazon if you want to order it.
Thank you.
Okay.
Calvin Lawrence, author of Black Cop. Imhan Deasy, did you have a question for Mr. Lawrence? You should be with us.
Yes, sir. Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes, sir. Greetings, Mr. Lawrence. Hello. Yes, sir. Thank you. I had a question, or a few questions, if we have time. My first question is in reference to a statement that you had made that the two things that are not going to go away is policing and black people. I wanted to ask about policing. If you think that it's not going to go away, but like, is there an example of policing before the system of white supremacy? Well, I guess my question is, has policing always existed?
Well, I think there was always some form of law enforcement. I'm not an expert on it, but I would suggest that there was always some form of law enforcement, whether it be the village people or some groups that took it upon themselves to be to enforce the laws or keep people safe. And what I mean by that is basically, you know, the police are not going. There's always going to be a police. You can call it a force, or you can call it a department, or you can call it a service. But there's always going to be people in uniform that are going to enforce the laws on the books. And as far, well, obviously, I'm not going anywhere. Black people that are growing up aren't going anywhere. The black people in the U.S. or Canada are not going anywhere. So now the choice has to be made. Do we hold individuals accountable for their conscious actions with the information that they have at the time, or do we just continue to fight each other and be at odds with each other? And to me, the way you fight that is you expose the individual police officers that are doing things wrong. And there are so many ways to do that, but for some reason, when a black police officer retired walks up and says, "Look, I know how to catch some of these black guys, these white police officers that are picking on black people," they said, "Nah, we don't want to talk to you." So, okay, well, now you march, picket, kick over church benches. I mean, do what you want, but there's people that know how to do this. And what I find even in Canada here is that I've offered my services. I'm a use of force instructor. I've offered my services to talk to black community groups in relation to doing some of this stuff, and there's been no takers. So suffer on, you know. I mean, all you can do is offer your services.
Yes, sir. And then I had a question about black citizens policing our neighborhoods outside of the quote-unquote police force that white people run. Again, I'm using the term policing twice, and I'm talking about, one, the police force, and then I'm talking about just protecting our own neighborhoods. So my question is, how do I, as a black man, protect my neighborhood or police my neighborhood, or get a group of people to police my neighborhood without involving the cops?
Well, there's a couple of programs. Some were taken from the U.S. Actually, one is interrupters who go into the black community and talk to people who are in gangs. Another, and I always say this, and this comes directly from Francis Cress Wellesley: get a broom, hand out brooms, and we make our communities clean, and we keep them clean because we're lining up the molecules of self-respect. And that's from Dr. Francis Cress Wellesley. That's not from me. But I think here's what happens is that I'm a retired police officer. I have a set of skills, organizational skills, speaking skills. I should be able to go to my community and offer my services for the benefit of my after retirement, just like other cultures can do, just like the Chinese culture can do, just like the Semites of the Jewish religion can do, just like the East Indians can do, just like the Koreans can do. But we can't do that because we have too many assimilation fantasies. We're too busy trying to be accepted by another culture, European culture. And that's kind of my way of thinking now. Maybe I'm a slow learner, maybe whatever, but we are never going to be totally accepted. So there'll be racial showcasing, the highest, the first, the only, and then there's going to be racial tailoring, which is minimizing your achievements and restricting your opportunities until such time as we have a black base. And this is what I say when I was talking about Condoleezza Rice and Colin Powell and the president. If they put their brains together for the betterment of our communities, that would be better. And the thing is, it's been done. Look at Black Wall Street. Look at Rosewood. So anyway, that's kind of my way of thinking.
Yes, sir. I had two more questions if I have time. If not, I'll just ask the one. One of my questions is, can white supremacy be ended? And if so, how soon?
Well, I think that white supremacy is never going to end. But here's our choices. Here's our choices. We as individuals, I'm doing all right. I know some other black people that are doing all right. But there are black people, their cries in the night are not being heard. And instead of concentrating on ending white supremacist behavior, why don't we improve our own lot in life as a culture in the nine major areas of people activity? White people have their flags. White people have their statues. I'm not going to chase somebody taking down a flag or a statue. What I'm going to do is build my own statue and hire my own people to do the work rather than reaching out. We seem to have to have the approval or at least the acceptance of white society. And that's what we've been conditioned to do, but I don't think that's going to work.
Yes, sir. So I'm going to not ask that last question I was going to ask because I can't quite ask it. So I'll go continue with this question. This will be my last question. You were saying that white supremacy cannot be ended. And I'm still trying to figure out exactly what your definition of white supremacy is. I was very confused, actually, whenever that portion came up, speaking about the definition of white
people
supremacy.
Because
I think you were saying that there's a difference between white people and white supremacists, and that black people will always be here, but I think that white supremacy means kill black people. So if they're successful with their ultimate goal, there will be no more black people, but I could be incorrect. So what is my question? What is your definition of white supremacy?
All right. The definition I have is there's white supremacist behavior and there's white behavior. Okay? White supremacist behavior is white people who wish to maintain dominance and control over non-white people in the nine major areas of people activity. White behavior is white people who just show up, they do their job, they go to work, but they do benefit from white supremacist behavior because that's their culture. So they benefit from it. They don't have to take part in it, but they benefit from it. And if you have a person who has no objective to maintain white supremacist behavior, but they're white, then that's what I would see as the difference. They just go to work, they get up and go to work every day and whatever. But it's harder on us because we have to determine that. We have to determine that very quickly. It doesn't matter if the guy's driving a bus and we put some money in whether he's a white supremacist or not. But if we're applying for a job or a promotion, now it's a different story. So we have to determine that because not all white people practicing white supremacist behavior say they are white supremacists. It's only the Ku Klux Klan and a few other people that say that they practice white supremacist behavior. But there's those people who are patting you on the back looking for the soft spot to put the knife. So that's what we have to deal with every day as black people.
Yes, sir. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Much obliged, Imhan DC. The caller, last four digits, 613-8, I think that is. I can't see it. The screen is on the other side of the room. The caller, did you have a question for Mr. Lawrence? Oh, that's absurd. They're going to make me check.
Hello?
Yes, sir. Caller Ranella, big victim. We can hear you.
Oh, okay. 613, y'all.
I couldn't see it. The screen is too far. Oh, there it is. 5136. We see you. I just needed to make the screen a little bigger.
Thank you, Gus. Mr. Lawrence, are you married to a white woman?
No, my first wife was white, and my wife now is First Nation.
Is who? I didn't hear you. I'm sorry.
First Nation. Indian.
Oh, okay.
First Nation, like the Canada call First Nations Aboriginal.
Oh, okay. Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you for letting me ask a question, Gus. And
no problem.
Answering Mr. Lawrence. Thank you.
Much obliged, big victim. How long were you married to your first wife, Mr. Lawrence?
About a year and a half.
Oh, okay.
Didn't work out. I mean, you see, with all of this, no matter if you're white, black, I don't care. You have family of origin issues, and you have family pathology that we have to work through. I mean, that's life. That's just a human on the planet. Mm-hmm. So we all have problems. We all have problems in our relationships, in our life, and you know. But I don't, you know, I don't mind talking about this because in my mind, I mean, what other human being on this planet has a right to take my personal inventory? I mean, is Jesus Christ hiring judges now? You know what I'm saying? So we all have our family of origin issues and our family pathology. And it doesn't matter who you marry. I mean, people marry whoever they think they're in love with who they're in love with. 'Cause love will transcend race. You know, I don't marry people because of their color, you know, that would not be when I was making choices, it wasn't about color. It wasn't about, that wasn't primary. The thing is, I mean, I know a lot of, women who don't want to be involved in any kind of racial, discussions or whatever. And I've met people of all races who want to be. So, you know, I mean, that's, who you marry does not define you. What defines you is your behavior.
We had another call I wanted to give really quick. I just wanted to ask, did you read Dr. Welsing and or Mr. Fuller, their commentary on sexual intercourse between white people and non-white people being incorrect? And Mr. Fuller, in fact, saying that that is a maximum act of racist aggression when white people engage in sexual intercourse with white people. Did you read that portion of Mr. Fuller's?
I know about it. Okay.
What do you think about it?
But well,
is it logical? Let me ask that. Do you think it's logical?
All right. It's logical, but it's not workable. And the reason I say that, okay, I did my 23andMe DNA, and I'm a light-skinned black person. The majority, I'm about 50-some percent sub-Saharan African, and then I'm about 20-some percent European, okay? So I identify as a black person. So would you say that... as a baby, and here's what I would ask, as a baby being adopted by a white woman and a black man, should I say that their marriage shouldn't have taken place? Should I be hostile towards either one of them for getting together? This is one of those things where you know, everything is great until you're put face to face with your principles. So how would I deal with that? And I don't say that looking for a fight or anything. I'm saying, okay, with that philosophy, how do I deal with that as a black man being raised by a white woman and a black man? How do I deal with that? What should be my thought process?
Following logic is generally what I recommend. And with those questions that you asked, my response was, because we've talked about that before, and we've had, you know, black people, non-white people who had similar situations. Sometimes they had, you know, their biological parent was white, one of them, and then they had a non-white biological parent, and they had to kind of deal with the same reckoning. That's one of the reasons why both Dr. Welsing and Mr. Fuller both say that this is incorrect behavior, and using those words specifically, that it's incorrect behavior. And that is all the word. They have many reasons, but that is one of the reasons that, as we talked about at the very beginning of the program, throw away children. Now, when all this bedroom activity happens and you have offspring who now have to process that we are in a system of racism, one of my parents is white, and it seems like a lot of people think that white people are causing this racism problem, and then one of my parents is black. Now, what am I to make of this? What am I to make of racism? I can tell you one thing that stands out as a staple. I can't think of an exception. I might be wrong, but I make generalizations about racism, white supremacy. I take the logical position that you can look at enough information where you can come to a logical conclusion that this is the general pattern. I think humans are wired to make averages, to make conclusions, to observe patterns. Yes, you have anomalies, but they are just that, anomalies. This is the pattern, and there are too many patterns to ignore with whites, including the running nigger target. One of those patterns is that biological white parents and/or even adoptive parents generally do not share information about racism, white supremacy with their non-white offspring. That seems to be a major rule. I've concluded that you cannot be white and be ignorant about racism. I've never met a white person who said that they didn't know what a nigger was. Never. Anywhere in the world. They understand, even in Australia. So you understand some of the basics. Just knowing that you are white is a whole lot right there. So you understand, if you're white, you understand a lot about racism, white supremacy, and the rule seems to be that they do not pass that information on to their offspring, even their partner. That tells me a lot. But I would process. Let me make sure I answer your question. The response would be, if I was processing Mr. Fuller saying that this is incorrect, I would look at that information, or I would look at that situation as best I could, understanding there's going to be a lot of emotion. Totally valid, but I was just trying to look at it honestly and make an appraisal. Someone is saying that this is incorrect, that the white person is practicing racism in a maximum way every time. Is that true? Does that fit my situation? And I would just try to make an honest appraisal, even though I would add that's probably going to be difficult because of the emotion involved for a lot of people. And I'll hush there. Your response?
Well, here's what I'm saying. This is why I say there's white supremacist behavior and there's white behavior. So my judgment comes from the behavior of people, and sometimes they're lying, and sometimes they're not being honest in a number of ways when it comes to race. But to blanketly say that there are white people and then there are black people, and then they shouldn't mix in the sense of marriage or friendship or policing or whatever.
Didn't say friendship. Wait a minute. We got to be accurate. Didn't say friendship.
Okay, you're
didn't
talking
say
marriage,
policing.
You're talking marriage,
nope,
right?
Didn't even say marriage. Sexual
all right, getting
intercourse
together and having
between
kids.
White people. Didn't even say that. Said white people and non-white people engaging in sexual intercourse. It's very specific. And Mr. Fuller is very specific, too. This is written down. That's what I'm saying. It's very specific.
Yeah.
And this ends up being a problem. People misquoting what you said about this. And it's not friendships. It's not policing. It's white people not having sex with non-white people. That's what it is. While the system of white supremacy exists.
So under my 23andMe, and I have a lot of European blood, would it be true that I shouldn't have sex with black people? Or would it be true I shouldn't have sex with white people? Based on the fact that I have the majority of blood being black. So what am I, is what I'm asking. So what am I when I have sex with women? Should I abstain from black women and white women? I mean, how should I deal with that, knowing what you know about me?
I don't have any confusion about your racial classification, just based on your book being titled Black Cop and being written all about you being mistreated, nigger yeah. targets, and what have you. It seems that white people have not classified you as a white person. Based on that, I would say the logic would apply that I don't think white people should be engaging in sexual intercourse with you. If they are, that is an act of racism on their part, just following logic.
Yeah. Well,
any non-white person?
Okay.
That would be my assessment. It, we did have one more call. This happens every time. This is favorite subject.
That's all right. I don't mind discussing this, but you know, I just look at my mother and father and say, well, you know, how should I deal with that? That's what I was basically saying. You know? Should I just look at that as being a racist act? My mother and father being together and having intercourse.
I believe.
It's okay. I don't mind talking about it. You know, I'm just throwing it out there because, again, we have principles until such time as we come face to face with those principles, and then it becomes, well, you know, gee whiz, I don't know if I can go through with my principles.
Absolutely. Emotions sometimes can make it very difficult for us to see logic. And I know on a personal basis that having personal relationships where you have some sort of emotional attachment to a person who is classified as white, it can make it very difficult to be honest about racism, white supremacy. I've had that experience myself, and engaging in sexual intercourse or being the product of such relationships, that is, you know, about as emotional as it can get. So it can make it very difficult. But I believe Ivy dialed in. Did you have a question for Mr. Calvin Lawrence, hanging out with us live in Canada, Ontario, if I got it correct? Ivy, did you have a question?
Oh, yes, I did. Greetings, Gus. Greetings, Mr. Lawrence, and to all the callers on the line. Mr. Lawrence, are you familiar with the 1921 Tulsa, Oklahoma situation?
Yeah, Black Wall Street.
Okay, are you familiar with the fact that, you know, there were several incidences like that, not just that one?
Yeah, there was Rosewood, and there was one in Shelburne, Nova Scotia, where I'm from.
Okay, are you also aware that there have been many interferences from white people whenever black people tried to build, where they will build freeways over their businesses, they will raid their businesses on unjust charges and just do, you know, various different things to try to stop them. Are you familiar with that as well?
Yes, I am.
Okay, so my question is, you made a statement, you said that instead of focusing on ending white supremacy and ending white supremacist behavior, we should focus on ourselves and, you know, try to build and things of that nature. And so my question is, how do you build if you're not focusing on stopping the people who are always interfering with you when you are building?
Okay, then I would go to the late Dr. Amos Wilson. And this is a quote, is we should think of ourselves as a nation within a nation, okay? Now, if we are turning it inward in our nine major areas of people activity, one of them is war, all right? So an act of another person, in my mind, in an act of one person hurting another person, that is war. So what do nations have? Nations have armies. So if you're a nation and Rosewood and Shelburne and Tulsa had self-protection, then it would be, I think people would think differently, or at least in their actions, if they knew that people would defend themselves. And this is why I cannot agree with the philosophies of Dr. Martin Luther King, because I think everybody should protect themselves. And I carried a gun for 36 years to protect people. And so I would put forth the philosophy of thinking as a nation within a nation. And if you do that, you have apparatuses to protect yourself, and that is lawful if you're being attacked.
Can you protect yourself if you're not focusing on the people who are attacking you?
Well, if I'm a nation, you have nations all over the world, and I don't see anybody saying, well, we're going to go to Saudi Arabia and we're going to stop them from doing what they do every day in their culture. That's all culture is what you do every day. Now, if one nation attacks another nation, then you have an army to protect people. So if you build Tulsa is a good example. If they're building and at the same time fortifying their processes dealing with war, then when someone shows up to take it from them, you fight back. But I'm not going to go out and look for people to say, you be part of my culture and you do this, you take down that statue. You can have all the statues you want because a statue is not going to hurt me. You can have all the flags you want. A flag is not going to hurt me. What's going to hurt me is your behavior. And if you come to hurt me, and this is as an individual basis, if somebody comes to hurt you, are you going to turn the other cheek or are you going to fight back? And if you're going to fight back, then you have to prepare yourself to fight back. Because if you say no, then all you're doing is begging if you're not prepared to enforce that no.
Okay, thank you for answering my question. I'll mute my line. Thanks, everyone. Thanks, Jeff.
Much obliged, Ivy. Thomas in New York dialed in with a question. I just wanted to say quick, those Rosewood, Florida, Black Wall Street in Tulsa, Oklahoma, those instances of black massacres where black property was stolen, dozens, countless black people were killed and forcibly purged from their homes, residences, houses.
Yes.
That happened more than 250 times in the U.S. alone. That's not counting Africville and other black areas around the globe. The book Buried in the Bitter Waters, Elliot Jaspin was a guest on the program, and he documents the more than 250. We read James Lowen, Sundown Towns, where he also documents a lot of deliberate efforts by whites, not only to carry out these purges, more than 250 of them documented, but to then cover them up and lie about the fact that this had happened. That hugely important. And just for added information, in Tulsa, Oklahoma, at Black Wall Street, I believe there's photographs of them using a helicopter to drop explosives on the black residents.
Yeah, that was in Tulsa,
That being the case,
that's what I read too. Yeah.
I'm not sure how black people at that time under a system of white supremacy would have defenses for aerial bombs being dropped in the early 1920s. But that notwithstanding, I did want to get Thomas in New York. Did I have one more question I wanted to make sure I get in? I'll get Thomas in New York. Thomas in New York, did you have a question for Mr. Lawrence? Proceed.
Good evening, Gus. Good evening to the callers. Good evening to Mr. Lawrence.
Hello.
I was listening to what you just said. Nations have borders. And a nation within a nation, that doesn't exist. Like, you... In Tulsa, they fought back. They backed the white people up. And the white people called in reinforcements. Very quickly, like Gus said, they came with aerial superiority. I'm confused. Were you born from a white parent, or is
no? My birth parents were black.
Okay. Okay, that makes, so you were raised by a white woman and a black man, or a white man and a black woman?
A white woman and a black man.
Okay, who had the power within that relationship?
the males. My father had the power, because in that day and time, and here's the thing, women are killed all over the world, and it's outright, but in our society, it wasn't written on the fridge or anything, but in our society, men had the power.
Gotcha. You follow me?
Now, just an answer to your question, and I'll also answer the other question there. And this, again, is from Dr. Frances Quest Wellesley. She talks about Vietnam. Now, no matter what you think about Vietnam, she says that little tiny people, and I'm quoting her, little tiny people, little tiny country, they said if every one of us has to die, white supremacy would not take place in this part of the world. And they dropped a lot of bombs. Now, I'm not picking sides here. I'm just saying that you have non-white people who overcame white supremacist behavior. And that's a good example when you talk about Rosewood and bombs and planes.
Well, if you look at what used to be called Saigon today, it looks exactly like New York City. So I would say that the white supremacists ultimately won that war. Motherboards inside our computers and stuff like that too. But I'm back to the power dynamic. If that's your answer, you know, I was quite sure that Dr. Wellesley had a lot to say about the power of white women. But you said you're a seventh generation Canadian. How did you come to that determination?
I checked my roots and you go back seven generations, and York Lawrence was the property of Catherine Lawrence in the province of Albany, New York. Now, because his name was York, and it was in York, it was in the province of Albany, and his last name was Lawrence, which was a slave name, I would have to go there and go back further to find out where I came from. But when I did my DNA, I was sub-Saharan African for most of my DNA.
Okay, I'm quite sure if you follow that first lead, you'll find that the DNA test was wrong. You'll find that your mother was, or your descendant was probably from here.
I'm sorry, I can't hear you.
I said you'll probably find that the descendant that you were talking about when you follow back further in Albany, New York, that you'll find out that you probably don't have any sub-Saharan heritage. But my last question for you, sir, is you said that you were a police officer.
36 years,
A Canadian mount. Do y'all ride around on horses, like with the boots, with the red jackets and stuff?
That's it.
When you were a police officer, I know you said that you worked in the capacity of, like, personal protection, I guess, like a secret service. But
that's correct.
Say that there was was there the disproportionate amount of blacks that were arrested in comparison to whites?
Well, to policing, then we didn't arrest people. Because, you see, in protective policing, instead of going out to get the person something.
Not in protective policing. I'm talking about as a police officer, like of your observations, because I would imagine that if you're protecting people, you're not arresting people. I'm talking about in Canada as a cop. You know, you're a Canadian cop. I'm sure they...
Well, we don't... it's pretty hard to make that distinction because we don't have the large black population areas that you do in the U.S., but I will say this. There are police officers that went into my community that were white to hunt. Do you follow me? To hunt. To get the stats up, to get promoted, to hunt. And then there are police officers who went there to work with the community for the betterment of that community. There were white people that did that, and then there were white people that went into the community to hunt. Now, these people that went into the community to hunt are masquerading as police officers because they're not following their oath. when really they're practicing white supremacist behavior.
Did you ever report those people to a higher authority?
When I say they went in there to hunt, they arrested people because one of the things I said was that you don't police communities the same. You treat people the same. And I'm sure that there are some communities you go into, you could arrest people for anything. Or you just try to control it. And there are other areas that it would not be tolerated. If you go into a rich area and you go sell drugs on a corner, how long do you think you're going to be there? You're not going to be there very long. But there are areas where people can sell drugs on a corner. And neither one of them should be allowed to do it. So when you say, did I report people, first of all, they weren't necessarily doing something wrong. They were just dealing with people that might have been poor and breaking some municipal law or some alcohol law. And you're assuming that by reporting it, that the people you're reporting it to, because they are of a higher rank, are going to be supportive of what you're reporting. And my book, if anything, get it on Amazon. My book, if anything, shows that when you report wrongdoing through the ranks, up to the politicians, up to senators, nobody does anything. That's clearly spelled out in my book. Hello?
So you did report these people, or you're saying that you did? Who did you report?
No, I didn't report anyone because they weren't doing anything wrong. What they were doing was policing a community where it was very easy to find a charge. Loitering, open alcohol. For example, if you have a club, if you have five clubs on a street, you can make arrests like crazy with people with open alcohol. Or you can try, in some cases, to control that open alcohol, that person with open alcohol, or the people with open alcohol. You're working with the community, and you're working with the people. But arresting your way out of all of these people drinking is only going to cause resentment, and in fact, it might even cause riots and conflicts.
Got you. Now back to your adopted parents. Are they still alive, sir?
No, they passed away now.
Oh, okay. Did you love your white mother like as she was your own mother? Did she treat you like a real child?
Or did you feel
like there was a problem?
Okay. No. My mother and father. I love them. They love me.
Got you. Well, that's my last question. Thank you, sir.
Okay.
Much obliged. Thomas in New York. That was the other thing I was going to say. He reminded me. Mr. Fuller, in addition to his code book, he has a word guide. And the first word that he has in the N section is nation. And he writes, use this word with caution. During the existence of white supremacy racism, always say that no other nation of people exists in the known universe except the white nation, nation of white supremacists, and or the race nation. Reason, in a known universe in which all the non-white people are directly or indirectly dominated by white supremacists, only those white people who practice white supremacy racism can and do function as a nation. All other persons are either individual white people who do not practice white supremacy racism, or they are non-white people who are subject to the white nation. He does have a few questions. What exactly is a nation? One of them, is it possible for a nation to be in or inside another nation? Can a nation be subject to a nation and at the same time be a nation? These are all just questions he recommends that one asks. Mr. Neely Fuller, producejustice.com. I did want to ask, you mentioned Jane Elliott in the book, White Woman. She does the brown eyes, blue eyes exercise. You mentioned
yes. Her.
It's down in the 200s. Here we go. You say, I think of Jane Elliott, the teacher and trainer behind the famous blue eyes, brown eyes experiment. As Elliott has consistently shown, when you put a bunch of white people in a room for 3 hours and treat them like black people, they can't stand it. They go crazy and leave. And I said, well, number one, Jane Elliott being a white woman, do you think Jane Elliott is a racist white supremacist? Do you suspect that she could be practicing racism?
Her behavior does not indicate that.
Okay.
See, because I look at behavior.
Right.
Yeah.
All
That's
right.
why I always say white supremacist behavior, white behavior. Emphasis on behavior.
Much obliged. In addition to Dr. Welsing and Mr. Fuller, Jane Elliott has been a guest on this program quite a few times. During one of those visits, she admitted to being a racist white supremacist more than once because she's come back repeatedly. She can detail why that label is accurate. I think she did in the archives why that label is accurate to say, yes, admitted racist white supremacist. The next question I was going to, or the next, yeah, the next question was, I'm familiar with her blue eyes, brown eyes exercise, and particularly the one that she does with older people. Older white people is frequently in a workplace capacity where that is a part of their job requirement to sit there for a few
right.
hours and go through this. So they're being compensated for being there. I don't think it's accurate as someone who encourages people to pay attention to comparisons. Jane Elliott does not treat the white people in her workshops like black people. That is a false statement, I would say. I've never heard of anyone in her workshops being castrated, raped, denied a job, denied a promotion, or any of the myriad of things that happen to black people. If anything, she may mildly annoy them. But again, they're being compensated, and they know that this is for a limited period of time. Maybe she's a little rude. She has, they have videos. She does not treat them like black people are terrorized in the system of racism, white supremacy. And in fact, I suspect if someone were to ask them, are they being treated like black people? Is that an accurate statement? I suspect that she would say, no, that's not true. They're just being, you know, annoyed or what have you. You're just getting a sampling of what mistreatment is like, but they're certainly not being treated like black people. Do you think that's accurate to say that they're being treated like black people for these few hours?
Well, I think it's accurate to the point of being in the workplace and being treated the way that she treats some of the white people there. Now, we're not talking about violence. I mean, no other police officers ever threatened me with violence or kind of or going to castrate me or hang
running,
me or beat
running
me.
Nigger, I think, is a threat of violence. If I'm working with someone who is trained with lethal force and you are putting up a running nigger target in my workplace, I think that is a threat of violence.
You have to realize I'm trained with lethal force too.
Like okay.
I've had encounters with police officers from different police organizations, and I basically said, okay, you arrest me, and I'll arrest you, and we'll let the judge sort it out. Of course, I can't do that now. I'm retired. But what I'm saying is they can do things to me, but I have the same ability to do things to them. Now, the way I look at it is that can that target hurt me? No. Can a Nazi flag hurt me? No. In fact, I'm glad they put it up in some ways because that tells me that they're practicing white supremacist behavior, and I don't have to try and make a decision on whether they're practicing white supremacist behavior or white behavior. I already know because of their flag or that running nigger target.
But Jane Elliott isn't even doing that. She's not putting up for those 3 hours. She's not putting up, you know, little paraphernalia suggesting violence against the brown-eyed people in her exercises. I've never heard of that, anything suggesting violence or direct physical harm to these. But that's what I'm saying. And so much, and she would acknowledge this. So much of the system of white supremacy is about violence against non-white people. They're not subjected to that. That's not a part of it at all. They're just mildly annoyed. She's talked about their videos. She makes them stand up, and they can't go in the room first. They don't get a chair. If that were
yeah.
what black people were treated like, we wouldn't have black cop. That's not, yeah. Let's see. I think
well,
I got. Go ahead.
The thing is, when some of these things were happening, you didn't have, like, for example, I put in the book there that somebody could say nigger if they're not talking to you. There's nothing you could do about it. Now you can't do that, supposedly, okay? You never had harassment policies. Now you have harassment policies, supposedly. So what I'm saying is white supremacist racist behavior is established, maintained, advanced, and refined. Now the refinement says is, well, I'm a conservative, or I'm part of the religious right. Well, if you're a conservative, what are you conserving? Ask them that. What are you conserving? So this linguistic camouflage and what's going on. So when she talks to these people, people have talked to me like that, right? People have talked to me like that. So in that particular instance, I'm not afraid of violence. I mean, if you now I know what you're going to do. But when I start talking to you in a certain way and I start beating you down day after day after day, tone denoting attitude. I guess there was a program where the lady called it mini racism, mini racist behavior, little things, and she comes out with that. So from that particular standpoint, she makes them feel the way that a black person would feel, minus the violence.
Jane Elliott, who makes sometimes $8,000, $7,000 U.S. dollars to these workshops, sometimes more, according to her own testimony, admitted racist. She practices racism. And I asked her specifically, those workshops that she does she have any evidence that they are effective at eliminating racism? And she said no. She had anecdotes, but she had no evidence. At any rate, Mr. Calvin Lawrence's book, Black Cop, it is available at Amazon.com. It has amazing anecdotes about a 36-year career in law enforcement and battles with racism, the alcohol and debauchery that is standard part of the culture of policing, it seems, U.S. and north of the border. But it is absolutely amazing. I would encourage folks to check it out. Reading is more important than watching television. And for all of the attention on white supremacy and policing in the States, again, more evidence that this is a global problem. Just to see the illustration of the official running nigger target. To check that out, I can give you the exact page number. Give me a second. And all that entails with that. But it has been a pleasure to have Mr. Lawrence visit with us this evening. It is almost midnight in his part of the world, so he has been super gracious with his time to hang out with us so late into the Wednesday evening. Did you have a final comment or commentary you wanted to make sure you get in before we let you go get some rest?
First of all, I'd like to thank you for having me. I'm very humbled to be discussing people that I've learned from. I thank the callers. If there was some way that I could make myself available at any time, you or anybody to ask me questions, and I think that I've been asked some very hard and pointed questions, and it makes me think, and I really appreciate that. I really appreciate that, and I want you to know that. So I really appreciate it for having me on.
Mr. Calvin Lawrence, the author of Black Cop, My 36 Years in Police Work and My Career-Ending Experiences with Official Racism. Definitely worth the read, and the official Running Nigger Target is on page 149. From the Toronto drug section. Thank you again. It has been just a pleasure to have you on to share again your distinguished law enforcement career. I'm so thankful that you were able to share some time, and we will definitely take you up on that to see if we can get you back on the program and chat some more, discuss your career, your book, your views on racism.
Anytime, sir. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Check your email. I will get you the MP3 so you'll have a copy of the broadcast.
Thank you. And anything you need or you want to visit sometime, come on up.
That is the plan. That I'm trying to get to Vancouver. If you go to Vancouver, that'll give me an excuse to get up to that part. But that is, I will keep that in mind. I loved visiting Toronto. Would definitely love to get back north of the border too.
Okay, anytime, sir. You have an open invitation.
Thank you so much, Mr. Lawrence. Enjoy your evening. We'll talk soon.
All right. Bye bye.
Be well.
Thank you.
Context of white supremacy. We got two workplace racisms this week. We'll have workplace racism on Friday, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. We'll have some of the same problems. Black people not getting promoted, not getting compensated correctly on the job. Some of the exact same things Mr. Lawrence talked to us about this evening, Friday, 8 p.m. Eastern. And he asked questions. I was so pleased about that when they the boxing situation. Is this against policy and procedure for me to participate in the boxing tournament? Asking questions. Talk about that all the time. Two workplace racisms for the week. We will be here tomorrow. The book club, 8 o'clock Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. Toni Morrison's Tar Baby, the late Toni Morrison's Tar Baby. 5 p.m. Pacific, 8 p.m. Eastern. We are... I think chapter 6, if memory serves, chapter 6 in the text. This will be our 6th study. So we had workplace racism there, too, last week. They had the big scene with Ondine and Mrs. Street. It was workplace violence. They had racism. She was upset that they had fired the black help and didn't even tell her, and now she's got to do all this extra work. And they ended up having that big fight in the kitchen. The black Ondine, she smacked the white woman. Mrs. Street struck her across the face. They were brawling in the workplace racism. Workplace racism, but that is Tar Baby, Toni Morrison's novel, which is all about racism, white supremacy. That is tomorrow, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. I guess the folks that dialed in, any folks have any questions, comments they need to get in? Mr. Street was so kind with his time to hang out with us this evening and answer our questions and what have you. Any folks have a question or thoughts they wanted to get in before we call it a Wednesday broadcast?
I haven't.
Yeah, can I be heard?
Let's see. It was a number of folks. Big Victim, Alabama. You want to go first, and we'll nab the other folks too.
I think Mr. Lawrence was very confused. Yes, for him to read the guidebook for Mr. Fuller. And not to know that the ultimate form of racism is being in a relationship with a white person. Very confused, but when I was listening to him, when he said he had a white adopted parent, I said, oh, he's white identified. So, yeah, that's all I had to say. Thank you for letting me share that.
Big Victim in Alabama. I am still confused myself. Still, still learning. And I will say,
can I get a question?
Oh, absolutely. Just I wanted to say real quick. I will say that I think Dr. Welsing herself and Mr. Fuller. Sometimes I know Dr. Welsing. She used to say it all the time that those their counter racist concepts, it can be difficult to understand. Dr. Kanban, I think, talked about it. It's different between knowing something and understanding, like, where you, I get it, and I can even grasp and apply this, like, on a personal level, how it's operating in my life, and it can be difficult to assimilate and really grasp some of those ideas. When Dr. Welsing used to say she would get some people, and they would read her work and say, oh, I used to think you were crazy, or I didn't understand this, or it didn't make sense. They would say, it took me years before it finally, boop, where I connected it and it made sense why you were saying what you said. They are not concepts that I think are the easiest to grasp, especially in a system of racism where everybody is saying these Negroes are crazy anyway. Thank you for your patience, sir. Proceed.
Yeah. When I ask them the question, and I hear this a lot from my victims, when they make statements like, other black people that look like you will be your own worst enemy or harm you the most. And when I ask them, they give me examples of a black person that, you know, that some way, somehow, even on the workplace or other instances, that was the most haunted. They really can't give me clear examples of how anybody black stopped them from getting a promotion, getting a job, entering college, denied any medical care, you know. So, you know, that comes up a lot. That's something that really stuck out to me with the guest.
Much obliged. Much obliged. Condoleezza Rice. I thought, I think I said it. I thought it was in similar, the portion where I was saying, I thought it was kind of sad having to drive around coworkers who are suspected racists, minimum, who are drunk in a night of debauchery, and then you have to drive them around. Like, man, that is minimum. That is not cool. Sad, as I said. But in his response to that, Mr. Lawrence, where it got to Condoleezza Rice and them, not Colin Powell, not using their brain power to help black people, I kind of thought the same thing. Like, which again, that is a pattern where the attention will somehow move from racists, individuals classified as white who are causing the problem, to the victims and how we are responding. That is pretty consistent pattern. Were there other folks who had a hand up?
Can I be heard?
Imhan DC, I thought I did hear you.
Yes, sir. Thank you. I just wanted to say to Mr. Lawrence, it's really cool that you made it that far in your boxing career. I think that is really cool. I admire that. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Should have been at the 76 Olympics. Like, I think that would have been the case. If he were a white person, I think they would have found a way. They would have got leave time. And it would have been, you know, a source of pride. Like, this guy is serving his country, like dually serving his country. He's an enforcement official and he's going on the Olympics. Like, oh my gosh, it would have been bigger than Rocky. Geez, should have been on the 76 Olympic team trying to get that gold medal. But that, and he in the book, he quotes Langston Hughes' A Dream Deferred several times in things that happened with his enforcement career, as well with his boxing career. Like, you know, what could have happened if there were not a system of white supremacy racism? Wow, things could have looked drastically different with his accomplishments and what have you. Were folks satisfied? Any other thoughts before we wrap up again?
Can I be heard?
Thomas in New York. Yes, sir.
Yeah. Man, you left out MLK. We also had a problem with Martin Luther King. Very digerish. The guy, a black man with a white parent, with a white wife, and he's a cop. I mean, it gets no worse than that. I mean, man. Either way, Gus, a nation within a nation. So we're going to build a nation inside the United States. What are we going to trade with? We're going to trade some athletes and entertainers. Like, you know, reports we got. You know, where are they going to put this at? Who's going to determine where it's going to be? You know, it's like, man, that's just not using really good logic in my opinion. But other than that, though, good interview, Gus, and I'll mute my line. Thank you.
Much obliged. That is very common. If anything, global system of white supremacy racism, that is very, two of those, and it's really, in my view, it's the same thing. The word community, because that was used a lot this evening, and nation. These things cannot exist, or at least you do not have a black community. That's in the word God, too. I'm not going to read that one, but that's in there, too, and it's the same thing. There's one community, the white community. If there were a black community, we wouldn't have an issue about policing. If black people had a community, it would just be get out of here. Communities can protect themselves. They can regulate. Wouldn't have to worry about white people killing black enforcement officials because all of that would be taken care of. And they would have, as he said, the defense mechanism to keep out these rogue officers so that these things don't happen. Black people don't have that anywhere in the known universe, as I understand it, because you can't have a community if you are subject to a system of white supremacy. Again, some of that is just, it's kind of racist logic. You don't have a nation if you're subject to white supremacy. You don't have a community if you're subject to racism, white supremacy. But it's very common to hear people talk that way. And I've said before, some of this, I think, is just when we get to a point where we are following logic and being more mindful with the way that we articulate this problem, I think that will push things in a correct direction, like really being mindful. And we've just, some of this, we've been talking this way for a long time. We've been saying that. That's the way it's been articulated. The black community, you hear that everywhere you are, everywhere, all over the world. Apparently people are saying it that way. The black community, that doesn't exist. As doctor, you don't have a black family. You have black survival units. You don't have a black community. You don't have a black nation. Even on the continent, you don't have a black nation. You have a system of white supremacy, and individuals classified as white show us that better than I can articulate it every day.
Also, Gus, you said, Mr. Moss said that white supremacy would not be defeated. I do not agree with that, and I feel like he's very comfortable with the system when he says something like that with NYD Jackson that question.
Well, VGQ, I certainly, reading his book, didn't get the impression that he was super comfortable. It was a lot of mistreatment. The official running nigger, I guess I'll end there. Does anybody using counter-racist logic, do they think that that is a violent threat to have that posted in your work area by individuals who are trained with lethal force and armed to have such an item posted in your workstation? Is that a violent threat, or am I...
Not only a violent threat.
Absolutely.
The way he went about it was like, well, I'm trained with lethal force too. Like, but you're outnumbered, man. Like, you're on the police force. I don't know a police force that got that many black cops to help you. So, and especially in Canada, where I think it's only 3 million black people in the whole country, and the country's larger than the United States in area. So. It just doesn't seem logical, his own stance in that instance where, you know, you're around 100 people trained the same way as you, but you know how to do the same things they do, but it's 100 of them, you know. It doesn't make sense, unless you're Rambo.
And them cops, the cops that killed that little boy in Louisiana, they told him in jail, they let him in cops, but if this person killed that white lady, they told him. Like I said, I stand by what I said about Mr. Lawrence. I think he's very confused. That's my opinion. Thank you for letting me share.
Yes, sir. And I assume folks are satisfied. We did our time.
No, dear.
Oh, they were not satisfied, Ivy.
Thank you, guys. Oh, man, and I just lost the page with the notes. Okay, so he made a, for lack of words, a comparison with respect to sexual relationships with white people versus friendships and things of that nature. And I actually agree with that comparison because I don't think any of it should be done because I think that it is very similar in its ability to confuse people. And friendships with white people, just like sexual relationships with white people, are sad, like, because you see people making space for white people and things of that nature. There was this man who, this black man who was talking about whites when they gun down children in schools and do all types of things of that nature. And he talked about how when racism isn't working for you, you just lash out and you do these different things. And then when he was finished, he started saying, you know, two of my best friends are white. And he looked into the camera and he just apologized profusely for saying what he said and was telling them like he meant what he said, but that, you know, he was just begging them to not get upset with them. And I think that intimate relationships are intimate relationships, and that if someone is good enough for you to have an intimate relationship with them and you love them and this, that, and the other, and this friendship and this, that, and the other, they should be good enough for a sexual relationship as well. But if they're not good enough for a sexual relationship because they're racist or whatever the case may be, they shouldn't be friends or any of that or any of those things either, because they also confuse and they restrict you can see that it restricts your ability to talk about racism openly and to talk about it honestly and things of that nature. And I wanted to just say two more things. One was a question. He talked about career-ending experiences with racism. Did he get fired or something because of over a racist incident?
He retired. He had over a 20-year career with the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, but he had lots, and I mean lots, of instances of racism, white supremacy, where he was not being promoted, working for a long time, training his supervisors and things, and not being promoted. I think towards the end of his career, it was so many workplace racism things in the book, couldn't get to them all, but he was able to submit a request for information. And so he got all of these emails that showed how unjust networking, that the whites were colluding to keep him from getting a job and sharing this information with people who had nothing to do with his hiring situation and just practicing racism flagrantly. And so they went through mediation, they had a settlement, and it just made it unbearable in the work conditions, because now this, as he said, uppity nigger who's filed a suit and made us look bad and got all this publicity about us practicing racism, that it was just really toxic. It was having a huge impact on his mental health that he talked about, where he gained all this weight and was really stressed and was depressed. And so he retired after 20 some years on the force. And could devote more time to his health, his life, and other things. But he was not fired. He retired after many instances of white people practicing racism in a variety of ways in his time as an enforcement officer.
Okay, and so thank you. And the last thing I wanted to say, man, what you said tonight, like, it really made me think, because I didn't think about this at first. And when I think back to it, it's about Jane Elliott. She actually said that her workshops are demonstrations of what non-white people go through. And that was brilliant what you pointed out, that, you know, us not having a chair and things of that nature, like, that's not the same at all. And it, now it makes me think, like, that whole demonstration and those workshops and things of that nature, that one aspect of it is possibly her practicing racism by intentionally minimizing what non-white people go through, and to condition everyone to see the things that we go through and the mistreatment that we endure inaccurately as just these minor little, you know, we don't have a chair and things of that nature, like what you pointed out. So I didn't even, like, think about that was probably, you know, one of her goals, to get up there and to minimize our mistreatment and to just condition everybody to see it just inaccurately. So I'm grateful that you pointed that out. And so I'll mute my line. Thanks, Gus, and I'm sorry for interrupting you.
Right on, Ivy. Jane Elliott in the archives, admitted racist in the archives, admitted racist. And that's standard operating procedure. We heard that term. I'd never even heard this before. The term mini racism, I think Mr. Lawrence was talking about. Mini racism. They have another term. It wasn't used tonight. Microaggression. It's consistent. It is terrorism. Again, that was Dr. Welsing, since her name has been invoked so much this evening. She did strongly and many times on this broadcast encourage black people. Racism, white supremacy, is the number one form of terrorism in the known universe. And in my view, an official running nigger target, that is an act of terrorism. That is designed to have me fearful. Like, what is going on? That's not a joke. That's not funny. You having a target up where we're going to take aim at a black person, at a nigger, and you're the nigger. That is an act of terror. That is the exact definition, to have someone fearful. Make them afraid. I don't know what's going to happen here. Wow, I'm concerned for my safety. That's what white people do all the time. That's exactly what that sort of act is designed for, in my opinion. But that's not a microaggression. That's not mini racism. That is terrorism, white supremacy racism. Accurate, just being accurate with words, that's super important. And be mindful. I would encourage everyone, be mindful of that, any of these acts, to minimize and get away from accurately labeling what is happening. What's happening is white supremacy racism, terrorism, the greatest form of terrorism in the known universe. with that.
Gus, can I get one? Sorry, can I just get one more thing in?
Because
I just wanted to say that you just confirmed the question that I asked. So there weren't any quote unquote people who are classified as Black Canadians that stopped him from any promotion or even forced him out of the department. It was racist colleagues, white people.
Right. I was glad that question was asked as well. Where are the Black people in the hiring positions? Black people can make suggestions. Absolutely. Don't hire that nigger. We got it. That happens on a regular basis. But in terms of who's going to make the final decision, generally they do not give non-white people, Black people particularly, that opportunity too frequently. Even I don't even think President Obama could fire too many white. Anyway, ancient history. Black cop. My 36 years in police work and my career-ending experiences with official racism. Mr. Calvin A. Lawrence. I should have asked. I suspect Miles Howe is a white person. That is the person who helped with the book. I suspect might be a white person. I could be wrong. I should have asked that question next time. We'll see if we can get Mr. Lawrence back to ask that one. With that, we'll be here tomorrow. Tar Baby, Toni Morrison. The book club, reading is more important than watching television. We got two. The other workplace racism official will be Friday, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific, and compensatory call-in this Saturday. We did extend the deadline for the retreat, and I think I found the location where we'll still have all the same amenities, same spot right next to the Orlando airport, and we could even make it cheaper. People asked if you could work with us and make it more budget-friendly. I think we accomplished that on all accounts. More details to come. Much obliged for folks participating. I hope it was worthy of your time and energy. We'll be here in about 24 hours. I said I was going to say it again. Sobriety would be best under conditions of white supremacy. Whew. I can't even imagine a work environment where you have armed whites, suspected race soldiers, who threaten you, at least some of them, and then you have parties where you are driving racist whites and charged with getting them home safely. Like, whew. Sobriety would be best. In addition to being sober, let's be buckled up every time we are in a vehicle. Even if you are driving inebriated, suspected racists, be buckled up, passenger seat or driver. If you're driving, we are not on the phone. Let's do all that we can to minimize contact with race soldiers, apparently like some of Mr. Lawrence's colleagues. We do not want to be stopped by them, and who knows where things could end up. With that said, Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other Black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of Black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another Black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cow signing out. Thanks all for tuning in. I'm trying to remember the last time someone mentioned Condoleezza Rice on the program. It's been a minute. Former Secretary of State. Cal signing out.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim, your brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning. Mm-hmm. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.